This is Steve Maxner conducting an interview with Mr. James McFarland on the 4th of February, year 2002, at approximately 9:15 Lubbock time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas. Mr. McFarland is in Gardner, Maine. Why don't we begin with the your early life, sir, and if you would tell me when and where you were born and where you grew up.
I was born in Waterville, Maine, and I lived in the Augusta Gardner, Litchfield area until I was 15, and then the family moved to Connecticut,
okay,
where I lived for 25 years and graduated from high school there.
Okay. And when were you born, sir?
I was born August 24th, 1935.
How old were you when you moved to Augusta? Do you remember?
No, I really don't. I was very young.
Okay.
Very young, yeah.
So very little.
Maybe 1 or 2 years old.
So most of your memories of childhood are in Augusta and Connecticut?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. What do you remember about growing up in Augusta? What was the place like?
Well, I actually grew up in Gardner. I didn't end up in Augusta until I returned to Maine after I came back from Southeast Asia. And, living in Gardner was nice. It was a nice high school there.
Mm-hmm.
And we lived in the country, had 100 acres of land, and we did a little farming, chickens and raising potatoes and cucumbers, and we had a Jeep. I learned how to drive in a Jeep, and we also had a beach on the lake, Pleasant Pond, and it was very pleasant growing up here. It's a beautiful area here, lots of woods. Mm-hmm. I used to hunt as a young teenager, and it was used to swim all the time in the summertime, and the Navy, and that was in the latter part of World War II, and the Navy, the sailors from Brunswick Naval Air Station used to come up to our beach. We used to charge 10 cents apiece back in those days, and they'd bring them in by the busloads, and they'd come down to the beach, and it was a great day for us. They'd come down once a week on an R&R type thing, and they'd bring all their beer, and they'd bring Navy life rafts, and they'd go out to our floats and drink beer, and they had all kinds of beautiful steaks that they used to cook on our grills, and it was just a great experience.
Mm-hmm. Now, what did you hunt?
Deer, partridge, pheasant.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how old were you when you started the hunt?
Probably 14.
14, okay.
Yeah.
Was that something that your father taught you?
Yes.
Okay. Did you have any brothers or sisters?
Yes, I had three brothers, yeah. Four brothers.
Four brothers. How about sisters?
No sisters, no.
Okay. What did you enjoy about school as you were growing up there in Gardner?
Oh, I enjoyed the woodworking class. I had a great, interesting teacher, and I just in general enjoyed the school. I spent 2 years in Gardner and then went to Wallingford, Connecticut, and I finished my last 2 years there. And I found Wallingford to be a nice town, in just north of New Haven, and the teachers were all good there. It was a beautiful school, and it was a nice experience.
Mm-hmm. What subject did you enjoy particularly, besides woodworking, as far as like history, math, reading?
I liked history, and I liked English.
Okay.
And it's been so many years, and I've forgotten what else I studied there.
Okay. Well, let's see. How about sports?
I just remember Harry Truman coming to my high school when he ran for president. I'm really dating myself now, and he stood on the front steps of our high school when he was campaigning against Dewey.
Mm-hmm.
And on his whirlwind tour through Connecticut, and that was a very interesting day because it was quite a gathering there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What was your next question?
Oh, I was curious if you played any sports.
I didn't play for any of the school sports. But I used to love to play football out in the sand lots and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I played a lot of baseball and basketball, but I never really played on the school team, so.
Okay. Now, what did your parents do?
My father was in the lumber business.
Mm-hmm.
He had a couple of sawmills here in Maine.
Okay.
Then he retired to Florida, and he managed a real estate complex.
Mm-hmm. How about your mom?
She didn't work.
Okay. Stayed at home, took care of the boys.
No, she went into the antique business years and real estate business years later on.
Oh, okay.
She did quite well at it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see. When did you become interested in aviation?
Well, let's see. I was working in the supermarket as a bag boy,
mm-hmm.
and I had to join. I had to do some kind of military service back in those days, and I didn't really want to go in the military.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of a funny story. I waited until I was one day before I was 18 and a half, and I joined the local National Guard Army in Wallingford, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
And because I only had to go once a week in a 2 weeks of summer camp for 6 years.
Okay.
So I didn't want to go to Fort Dix and do all that training that they do down there. I just wasn't interested in the military.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was in there, I began to like it,
mm-hmm.
and I became a supply sergeant. And then I had a local fellow there by the name of Lieutenant Colonel Edward Polanski. He lived in my town. He lived in Wallingford, and he was in the Connecticut National Guard. He was a Korean vet, and he was a beaver pilot also. He flew beavers in Korea. And he used to fly over the Wallingford all the time in this little Bell, you know, the Bell helicopters that they use in MASH.
Mm-hmm.
The Bell H-13 bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that, and I said, you know, I'm tired of stacking cans on the shelves in the supermarket. I want to do that. So I started poking into it, and I found him, and he told me how to do it, and took me up to the Armory and showed me all the regulations on how to do it, and I did it. And I went to all the appropriate schools.
Mm-hmm.
I went to the Connecticut National Guard Military Academy for a year,
mm-hmm.
weekends with two summer camps, one summer camp down at Camp Niantic, I think it was called.
Mm-hmm.
It was named after the governor, and I can't think of his name. Or Ribicoff. It was named Camp Ribicoff back then, down in Niantic, Connecticut. I spent 2 weeks there, rigorous training, cadet training, and then I got my second lieutenant's bar. But then I had to qualify for an infantry school. My objective was to get to flight school, but I had to do all this to get to flight school. So then I went to Fort Benning, Georgia, for 12 weeks for basic training. Infantry, foot stuff,
mm-hmm.
and they sent me out to the boondocks, and I did all those things, escape and evasion, and so forth. And then I was fully qualified as an infantry officer, and then I immediately applied for flight school. And I went to flight school in San Marcos, Texas, and that was the primary,
mm-hmm.
and that was Gary Army Airfield. The Air Force used to control it, but then the Army took it over. And they made it into a civilian training camp for the U.S. Army for primary students.
Mm-hmm.
And I finished that and went over to advanced over at Fort Rucker for the tactical phase. We were flying L-19 bird dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And then I finished that course. And then I returned home. And then a couple of months later, I was able to slip into helicopter school at Camp Walters, they called it then. It's Fort Walters now.
Mm-hmm.
Which is out west of Fort Worth, and I did 2 months there, and I nearly was first to solo in my class there, but my instructor wouldn't send me up because I was having a bad day, but I was number two to solo in my class, which I thought was pretty good for me,
because
mm-hmm. I was competing with West Point graduates and Citadel graduates and so forth.
Okay. And this was Huey?
No. Primary helicopter was the Hiller D model.
Okay.
And, but I did qualify in the Huey later on, years later.
Okay.
10 years later.
Okay. What year was, what year did you go to Fort Benning?
Pardon?
What year did you go to Fort Benning? Do you remember?
Fort Benning, let's see, I went to Fort Benning in 1959.
Okay. And then at Gary Army Airfield?
Let's see, no, I'll take that back. I have to correct myself. I went back to Fort Benning in the fall of 58, and then I started in January.
Okay.
January, February of 59 until August of 59.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to helicopter school in 1960. Oh, yes, and I also did instrument training, civilian contract out of Fort Knox in Cessna 172s. I got my Army instrument rating, and then I took some sort of a general test with the FAA
mm-hmm.
on regulations, and I got my commercial license and my instrument ticket and helicopter rating out of that.
And when was that?
1960.
Okay. And your time at Fort Rucker and Camp Walters, same year?
It was about, it was 2 months at Fort Camp Walters.
Yes.
But the combination of fixed wing school
mm-hmm.
between San Marcos, Texas, and Fort Rucker, Alabama, was 8 or 9 months.
Okay. So all of this took place between 1958 and 1960?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Okay.
that's where I got my all my military training.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now,
all in Connecticut National Guard.
Okay. What took you, your family, from Augusta, Maine to Wallingford, Connecticut?
Economics.
Oh, I'm sorry, Gardner.
Economics.
Okay. Economics?
Sure. Like a lot of people.
Yeah.
Especially back in those days.
Yeah. Do you remember much, or did you hear stories from, say, your parents and from your grandparents about the Great Depression and things like that?
No.
Did it affect your family very much?
No, I wouldn't say so, no.
Okay. And how about World War II? Did you have any, did your father or do you have any uncles or other relatives that served?
Oh, yes, I have a very interesting story to tell on that. I had one uncle, my Uncle Jim, I was named after him, and I was born on the same day he was, strangely enough.
Oh, interesting.
August
24th,
1935.
Okay.
And he's a Colby College graduate. He went in the Army as, I don't know whether he joined or was drafted for World War II and ended up in England.
Mm-hmm.
And he returned home safely. And he became a vice president for Continental Can and retired, and now he's deceased. But my other uncle was an Annapolis graduate. His name was Robert Wing. And he graduated from Annapolis number 50 in his class, 50, 55, somewhere in there. And then he applied for active duty with the Navy, and they turned him down because he couldn't see too well. He studied so hard when he was in Annapolis that it affected his eyes. So he became an engineer down in Aruba at Eastern Standard Oil. They have the refineries down there. And then World War II broke out, and then all of a sudden the Navy decided he could see okay, so they sent him on a tin can on the North Atlantic chasing submarines, destroyer escort. And he got the Navy Cross, I think, for saving one of his sailors that was trapped between two boats that were refueling. One was his destroyer escort.
Mm-hmm.
And he spent 20 years in the Navy, and then he retired.
Okay.
He's since deceased.
Mm-hmm.
But he's a very interesting individual, and mm-hmm. he had a degree in engineering from Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. some school in Pittsburgh,
mm-hmm.
and I think he also had a law degree from Georgetown, and he had a degree in engineering in oil. He specialized mm-hmm. in oil for the Navy. That was his major in Annapolis, but I could be corrected on that, but I think that's correct. Because he got a job when he got out of the Navy as the director of the New England Petroleum Association.
Mm-hmm.
So his expertise in the Navy was oil.
Okay. Well, so did that have an influence on you at all, as well as in terms of your interest in aviation?
I can't hear you speak.
I'm sorry, did that have any kind of an influence on you in terms of your interest in aviation as it evolved?
No, I don't think so, but my okay. grandfather Wing, it's recorded out at the Air Force Academy that he invented the tail wheel. He was a draftsman, and he invented the tail wheel for the U.S. Army Corps, Air Corps.
Well, oh.
I guess it was prior to World War One, or whenever they first came out with those biplanes.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen the documentation on that, but it's well known in the family that's we consider it as a fact.
That's fascinating. Wow. Did you know him personally?
My grandfather?
Mm-hmm. Well, did he survive?
Oh yeah.
Into your childhood?
I was around him for years.
Oh okay.
Right here on this lake, as a matter of fact, I could see his place from here.
Oh wow.
That he used to own, yeah.
Okay. Let's see. And in terms of some of your other earlier experiences. Did you work much as a young man, say in Gardner before you left for Connecticut, then in Connecticut before you became you mentioned that you were a bag boy.
Oh, that was in Connecticut.
Right.
No, when I was in Gardner, I was, first 2 years in high school, and
mm-hmm.
it was kind of tough to make money as a kid then, but I used to work in the bowling alleys as a tin pins, and mm-hmm. I used to get them banged off my head every now and then.
Okay.
I was setting up the tin pins.
Uh-huh.
Picking up some money for spending, you know, for
yeah.
gas, for the car and all that.
Yeah. Okay. Now, let's see. When, when you were in Wallingford, Connecticut, what was that like? What was that transition like going from Gardner to Wallingford?
Oh, it was great. It was exciting. It was a new experience, different state.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was 15, 16, 17 years old, and I went to work in a supermarket there while I was going to school.
Mm-hmm.
It was a local market, and it was a And I became the grocery manager in it when I was probably 20.
Mm-hmm.
We used to buy direct from all the big manufacturers. Back in those days, you can't do it anymore. It's all done by distributors.
Mm-hmm.
It was quite an important job, and I learned a lot from it.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you graduated from high school, that would have been, I guess, around 1958?
No, 55, I think.
Oh, you graduated in 55?
Yeah.
Okay. What were your plans? What did you want to do with your life?
I really didn't have any.
Okay.
You know, I was like a lot of kids that age. You know, they're kind of like in limbo, waiting to see what they want to do, and then all of a sudden that helicopter flew over my house. I said, that's what I want to do.
Okay. What did your dad do there in Wallingford? Was it lumber business again, or something different?
No, he did something different then.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Was your house, in your house and your family, were politics and the events of the times discussed very much?
Not too much, no.
No? What did you understand about the Cold War when you graduated from high school and the relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union?
Oh, we were the good guys and they were the bad guys. That's basically it.
Okay. Did you have any relatives that served in Korea?
No, I had a close friend who went over there, a high school buddy who went over there.
Uh-huh. Did he talk to you very much about his experiences, explain what happened to him?
Not really. We were all back and forth.
Uh-huh.
While he was over there,
mm-hmm.
but I don't recall him saying too much about what happened over there, but he might have. It's been a long time ago, you know?
Yeah. Okay.
I've seen him since, but not very much.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead and describe what it was like going from your civilian lifestyle to going to Fort Benning in 1958 for your infantry training.
Oh, let's see, my wife at that time and I picked up, we packed up our stuff, no, the Connecticut National Guard shipped our stuff to Fort Benning, and we moved to Fort Benning, and they gave us quarters, which is very, very nice, and I did my thing for 2 months, studied at night in the spare bedroom, and we had a nice social life at the officers club, and she really enjoyed it very much there, and it was a typical army life situation.
Mm-hmm.
We used to go to Commissary PX, and we used all the facilities there and saluted everybody and stood at attention when we were told to and ran when we were told to, and just a typical army life.
Mm-hmm. What was the most challenging aspect of that training for you, that first training experience? Or was there anything challenging?
No, I really didn't want to be there, to be honest with you.
Okay.
So the aviation thing was nothing but a stepping stone for me to get into aviation. That's exactly what it was. And if I didn't have to go there, I wouldn't have gone there.
A necessary evil.
But it was good for me because then I understood more what the foot soldier
mm-hmm.
Needed in the way of support, you know, spotters and all that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's exactly why that they did that.
Mm-hmm. And then from Fort Benning, when you went to San Marcos for your primary, what was that like? And
we had to return home
uh-huh.
because, you know, National Guard officers just don't go from school to school normally. They have to come back and then apply because you got to graduate and all that. And
mm-hmm.
so we returned home, and I forget what I did. Let's see. Yeah, I returned home, and then we drove all the way to Texas, and we had our thing shipped down there. We rented a house outside of Camp Gary, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a nice ranch, and we got ourselves a dog, and I went to flight school every day, ground school in the morning, and we flew in the afternoons, and it was, the post was absolutely beautiful. It was managed by the U.S. Army, and I think there may have been still some Air Force advisors around there, because the school had recently transitioned from Air Force instructors to Army instructors, but they had a civilian contract there, and they had a civilian contract to teach us, and they had a motto. Unlike when the Air Force was teaching the people there, that it was their job to get us through.
Mm-hmm.
So the washout rate went way down.
Mm.
And they got people through, and they worked harder than maybe a military instructor pilot would. So we had a beautiful club there, and Hilo Hattie came there one time, entertained us.
Mm-hmm.
And the post was sort of very relaxed-like because it was mostly run by civilians, overseen by the U.S. Army.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was quite relaxed and quite enjoyable. It was really very enjoyable.
Okay. Now, what did you learn to fly there?
The L-19 Bird Dog.
This was the L-19. Okay.
Yes.
And what did you think of that aircraft?
Oh, great little airplane. Lots of power and safe machine.
Mm-hmm.
Very reliable.
Mm-hmm.
I flew my pants off when I got back to Hartford with the National Guard. I couldn't wait to get in there and go fly all over the world with it.
Okay.
I was young and eager then.
Uh-huh. Was there anything particularly challenging for you in that initial flight training?
Oh, yes. The whole program was challenging to me because I finally learned that I could learn how to fly an airplane, and it was kind of like a dream come true. And of course, it was the prelude to the helicopters, which I was really interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really fascinated by helicopters. But that entire course was very, very challenging for me. And the Fort Rucker part was very challenging because they taught us how to fly off short fields.
Okay.
And they used to put these ribbons up, and we used to have to come in and land over those ribbons and land on a 1,000-foot strip out on the boondocks at Fort Rucker.
Mm-hmm.
They had several staging fields there.
Mm-hmm.
And back to San Marcos, I actually soloed at New Braunfels, which is the next town down from
mm-hmm.
San Marcos.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an exciting day for me.
Okay.
As it is for everybody who solos.
Yes, sir. Now, of course, the L-19 is a tail dragger. Any problems with ground looping while you were there?
I don't ever remember ground looping that airplane anywhere. No, I don't ever remember ground looping at all.
Other students have any problems with that?
I don't remember it as being a major problem, but some people did ground loop it, sure, and
they're
bound to anybody who's starting to fly.
Yeah.
Has the potential to ground loop a tail dragger.
Right. Now, while you were there at Camp Gary, was that a washout offense? Ground looping the aircraft?
No, I don't think so. I don't recall being that.
Okay.
It probably was with the Air Force.
Yeah.
But not with the Army instructors, but not with the civilians, no.
Okay.
Not to recall.
Okay. And, let's see. Well, let's go ahead and talk then about your time at Fort Rucker. How much time was there between your time at Camp Gary and at Fort Rucker?
Well, we went directly to Fort Rucker.
Okay.
Because it was part of the whole program. In
mm-hmm.
order to get my wings, I had to go to Fort Rucker. It was called the advanced phase, and that was Fort Rucker is a fascinating post because there's so much aviation there, so many different kind of airplanes there,
mm-hmm.
even back in those days. And it was very challenging, you know, learning how to fly those airplanes in and off short fields. And of course, that's one of the reasons that I was hired by AirAsia.
Mm.
A couple of years later,
mm-hmm.
and it was we rented an apartment in I think it was in wasn't Dalton, I think it was in Enterprise, and it was a typical Southern home, and we just had a nice apartment in the back of this big home
mm-hmm.
that this elderly lady owned, and she was looking for the rent income.
Mm-hmm.
And I made some nice friends down there in that class. One of them was Joe Palastra. He was a first lieutenant. And he became the commander of the 101st Airborne, and then he went on to, I think he's retired now, but he became a four-star general commander of FORSCOM, and I think that's in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And the other man that I became friends with was Captain Brandenburg. He was our class commander, but he was a very, very sociable guy. It was just a pleasure to be on the flight line with him, have him as our leader. And he became the commander of the 101st Airborne also. And then he became a two-star general down at Tampa, and he was in charge of that draft machinery down there for all the draft people. He didn't like that job very much. As I talked to him, he was thinking about getting out of the Army, but then he got the job as commander of the Third Corps at Fort Lewis, Washington. I think it's 3rd Corps, but I might need to be corrected on it. Maybe it was 13th Corps. But he had a lot of troops in Korea, and so he used to go back and forth to Korea. And he invited me up to see him once at his house, Quarters 1 at Fort Lewis. And I had a layover up there when I was flying for American Airlines. but we misconnected. So I one time he was in Korea, and then and the next time we misconnected because I was in a different hotel. But I did talk to him the next morning on the phone. His aide tracked me down, but I couldn't go to see him because I had to go kick the tires and take off, you know. And he was a very very sociable, incredible person. I enjoyed meeting him. And there was also a Lieutenant Colonel Higgins was down there from the Connecticut National Guard, and I became good friends with him. And that was San Marcos and Port Rucker both. So that's pretty much the some of the highlights of that experience.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, and all this training was, again, in the L-19 at Fort Rucker?
Yep, that's correct.
Okay.
Tactical. They taught us how to spot artillery there, mm-hmm. and they taught us how to spot for artillery, and they also taught us how to do a short field, to do airfield recons, and mm-hmm. all that sort of tactical stuff in support of the ground soldiers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, in that, the short field work that you did, that's considered, the L-19 is considered a stall aircraft, isn't it? Short takeoff and landing?
Yes, but it's basically a spotter is what it is.
Okay.
Observation. You know, the Ravens used it over there in Laos.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent for spotting.
Okay.
They used it in Vietnam also.
Mm-hmm. Just out of curiosity while we're on this specific capability of the L-19, did you ever get to fly any of the other stall-capable aircraft in Southeast Asia, say the... I don't know, Helio Courier, anything like that?
Oh, I flew several airplanes in Southeast Asia.
Uh-huh. How did they compare to the L-19 as far as stall capability?
Well, the Helio and the Porter were uh-huh. were both superior in the takeoff distance.
Uh-huh.
They could probably land and take off on strips 25% less than the L-19 could, but the L-19 didn't have any capacity to carry anything except two people.
Uh-huh.
But the Helio had a capacity to carry a pilot and 500 pounds, and the
wow.
Porter a pilot and, I think, 800 pounds.
Okay.
But you might get different figures from different people, but that's pretty. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty good presentation, though.
Yeah.
I think it answers your question.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Well, let's see. And then when you went to Camp Walters, was that just like with Fort Rucker immediately after?
No, I had to return home and get assigned a slot. They used to assign the money and the slots for those things periodically. It didn't take very long, though.
Okay. And what did the training focus on there at Camp Walters? This was your helicopter transition?
Yes, it was in the Hiller D model,
mm-hmm.
and it was also civilian instructors. And, what can I say about it? They taught me how to fly a helicopter and auto-rotations
mm-hmm.
and doing maximum point takeoffs and how to do skid landings and just generally speaking, how to fly a helicopter.
Mm-hmm. Well, what did you find most challenging in this transition from fixed wing to rotary wing?
I guess being able to solo a helicopter, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a great day for me.
Uh-huh.
That was just a great day. I did it in about 10 hours.
Okay.
Which is pretty good.
Yeah. Now, what in terms of actually flying the aircraft, what was the most challenging aspect of flying a helicopter for you at first?
Oh, learning how to solo it.
Okay. Other pilots I've asked have said hovering. Would you agree with that as far as at one of the physical aspects of flying the helicopter?
Oh,
or?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay.
That would be part of the solo.
Okay.
I have to hover before I can take it off.
Right. Okay. Gotcha. And let's see. Now, in comparing the time that you spent at Camp Gary, then at Fort Rucker, and then back again at Camp Walters, where you had the civilian trainers at Camp Gary and Camp Walters, but military trainers, I assume, at Fort Rucker.
No, there was civilian again.
Civilian again.
Wow. No, let me see. Wait a minute. No, I think they were military, yes.
Okay.
Yes, I think they were military. They were Army pilots, yes.
Do you remember if the atmosphere and the training atmosphere was very much different compared to the civilian training
yes,
you received?
Yes, it's beginning to come back to me now. It seems a little more rigid over there, yes.
Okay,
yes.
At Fort Rucker.
Yes.
Okay. And, Let's see here. Oh, you know, were there any memorable events that occurred there at Camp Walters?
In the helicopter program?
Yes, sir. You know, not necessarily just for you, but for other pilot experiences, things like that, other student experiences.
No, nobody crashed that I can think of, and no, I draw a blank. It was a nice post. I can remember that. And we used to go to the PX and commissary and the club there, and it was just a nice experience. We used to drive to Fort Worth on the weekends and shop, and Fort Worth was delightful for us. It was all the big department stores. Neiman Marcus, that was a highlight for us.
Mm, okay. Well, speaking of airplane or aircraft losses, were there any losses of aircraft or personnel in any other training environments that you were in before Camp Walters?
No, one of our pilots got lost on the cross country down to Galveston, and they had the CAP and Air Force, and everybody was out looking for him.
Oh,
they finally found him, and he made it back okay.
Okay.
I'm happy to say that I made it okay. I could never figure out how they could get lost, because all you have to do is fly from Camp Geary to the Gulf of Mexico. How could you miss that? But he got lost.
Okay.
Other than that, I can't think of anything, except that we used to have a farmer that was outside of San Marcos, and he hated us.
Oh, did he?
I think he used to throw rocks at us, and whatever you could do. I told the story that he used to shoot at us, but I don't think that was true. It was a long time ago.
Okay.
But he was so ripped at us, because he had cattle, you know?
Uh-huh.
So what they did is the Army went out, and they met him, and they introduced himself, and they gave him a grand tour of the base and took him up on an airplane ride, and just they really pampered the guy. And so he was okay after that. He loved us after that.
Okay. Is it because the aircraft spooked his cattle that he didn't like you at first?
Yeah, we had the same problem up at Camp Drum in upstate New York, where that outfit, the 10th Mountain Division is. A lot of turkey farms there, so that was prohibited from us flying around. We didn't have any problem up there because we just stay away from turkey farms.
Okay.
But there was an interesting event that took place, or series of events that took place after that I left flight school.
Okay.
When they moved the school from Camp Geary to Fort Rucker. They closed that down. They put the whole thing up at Fort Rucker. Would you like to hear about that?
Absolutely.
Okay. It was probably 1960... No, let's see, I was in the last class that finished the primary. We were called the Black Hats. And there was a class behind us that didn't finish, that was the last class there, and they finished up over at Fort Rucker. But, you know, we had 200 airplanes, 200 L-19s on that ramp there at Camp Geary. And they moved all 200 of those airplanes over to Fort Rucker, and they just built these... Well, they were $20,000 in those days. They're probably $500,000 today. They built a couple of hangars there, and they just went to waste. They moved everything. There was a lot of politics involved in it, I believe. Moved everything to Fort Rucker. But they had four mid-air collisions because they had too many airplanes in one little vacuum. And within just a few months, and so they quickly moved the school right out of there, and now it's over in around Savannah at Fort Stewart, I think. Fort Stewart, Georgia. It's a Signal Corps base. I believe that's where it is today, and that's why they moved it.
Okay. Now, let's see. When you finished your training at Camp Walters, did you have to wait again for another slot at Fort Knox?
Oh, you know, I think I went to Fort Knox in the summer of 60. I went to helicopters in the fall of 60. So, yes, I did have another 2 months break between that.
Okay. And this was for your instrument training and your civilian pilot's license, correct, at Fort Knox?
Well, no, it was specifically for my military instructor, my military instrument rating.
Okay.
However, then when I got done with all of those things, then I could go to the FAA and take the FAR test.
Oh, I got you. Okay.
And based upon my graduating from all those military schools, then I was automatically given an FAA license.
Okay.
Commercial instrument, single multi-engine land helicopter.
Okay. What was most challenging about instruments for you?
Oh, that was a great program. There again, we had civilian instructors, and just being able to shoot those approaches under the hood, and looking up and being 200 feet above the ground, line up with the runway, and then land it and grease it in.
Okay. How long did that training last? Your instrument rating training?
It was a couple of months in the summer of '60 at Fort Knox.
Okay. And then what did you do after you finished all your flight training there in 1960?
I went to work for Wrigley's Gum.
Wrigley's?
Yeah, Wrigley's Gum. I had the state of Connecticut as my territory.
Uh-huh.
I used to go around to all the supermarkets and wholesalers, and then I used to fly on the weekends.
Okay, for the National Guard.
And I was up there every weekend that I get up there. Every time that they'd let us fly, I was up there.
Okay.
Flying the helicopters or the L-19s. And then they qualified me in the Beaver. Locally there at Brainerd Field in Hartford, Connecticut.
Okay. And what was that like? How did you enjoy that aircraft?
Oh, I love the Beaver. See, you go from an L-19 and all of a sudden you think that you're in a big transport. Yeah. Because it's got that big radial engine and it feels heavy and the cockpit layout, there's a lot more room in there and you can carry other people in there. The radios were better. That was like a big upgrade in my life, you know?
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, at what point did you decide that you wanted to fly full-time, that you wanted to stop working in other capacities?
I guess it's difficult to answer that question because it's so long ago, but I would say at the very beginning, the first time somebody offered me a job, I was gone from the gum company.
Oh, okay.
That's what happened.
When was that?
That was in January 1962. I left the gum company, and I went to work for a helicopter airline up in Boston called New England Helicopter Airlines, and we were flying a J-2 and a Cessna Skyhook.
Okay.
And we had a Brantley also. But that only lasted 4 months.
What did you fly for them?
I flew the J-2. I flew all three of those.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And I didn't like the Brantley very much, though. I really didn't like the Cessna. I really liked the Bell Ranger J-2. That's what I love to fly.
Okay.
I was the chief pilot there, and I had two other pilots working for me. One was an Army Guard guy from Rhode Island, and the other fellow was Commander Gluting. He was out of the U.S. Navy, and he had just returned from Southeast Asia flying for Air America. He was there. I think 2 months, he got shot down, maybe 3 months, he got shot down, spent 4 days in a jungle. And he said to himself, he says, "It ain't worth the money, I'm leaving."
Mm.
And he left. But then he ended up there flying for New England Helicopter Airways for me.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me all about Air America.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd never heard of it before, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Well, I'm going to try to get on with them." So I tried to get on with them as a helicopter pilot. And they said, "No, you don't have any heavy helicopter time. You got to have H-34 time or something like that." And then Andy was telling me about this Beaver program. I said, "Gee, you know, I'm qualified in the Beaver. Maybe I'll try them, but I won't try in the Washington office. I'll write out to Taipei, and they won't know they're already been turned down."
Mm-hmm.
So I sent a letter out to Taipei, and I got within about 10 days, the Washington office contacted me, and they said, "Come on down, we want to talk to you."
Okay.
And that was no less than the great General Dole, who was. When he died at age 75, he was written up in Time magazine or Newsweek,
mm-hmm.
and he was considered as the aviation spymaster of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And he also flew, I think he flew the first flight for Pan Am on the 747 ever, because he was a Pan Am pilot. And he was a two-star general in the reserves, and I think he was active duty at some point in time. But he was an incredible individual. My interview was with him, and he asked me some questions about, the chief pilot from Taipei was there too.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in the CAT office, the Civil Air Transport office in Washington, D.C. They sold tickets there, but in the back room they did their other stuff, like hiring people for Air Asia.
Okay.
And so I got my interview with him. He asked me a few pertinent questions about the performance of the Beaver and how much it could carry, you know, the landing and takeoff distance and all that. And I answered them all perfectly. And so they hired me, and 10 days later I was on a jet for the Far East.
Wow.
Northwest Airlines out of Kennedy. They got me a passport, like, overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on my way.
Wow. Okay, this is still in 1962.
That was in 1962, yeah.
Okay.
You have that written down on something I sent you there, I think.
Yes.
The exact date.
Before I get into the introduction of your service there in Southeast Asia, I did want to ask you quickly, because you mentioned a couple of aircraft that you had flown during your very brief time with New England Helicopter Airlines. You said you liked the Bell Ranger best. You didn't the Cessna very much. Could you tell me why? Do you remember?
You know, I can't.
Okay.
I really can't tell you. I don't know why, but I know that it wasn't very well liked helicopter, and they stopped making it.
Okay.
They had several accidents with it.
Oh.
After that,
mm-hmm.
But I just didn't feel comfortable in helicopter. I really liked the Bell. That's
mm-hmm.
what I liked. It was so much. It was easy to fly.
And what was the third aircraft you mentioned?
Brantley.
The Brantley. What didn't you like about that one? Do you know?
Well, it was a very light thing. It was shaped like an ice cream cone,
mm-hmm.
fuselage,
mm-hmm.
and it didn't have very much power in it. And I was taking photographs one day. I had a photographer with me. We were taking photographs of the slum area of downtown Boston. I think the charter was for the city of Boston, or the developer was going to develop that area. They eventually built the Prudential building down there, and it was a cold, windy day, and I got caught in a gust and lost 600 feet. And I know that wouldn't have happened in the J-2, because the Brantley was so light, and I just didn't like it. It was a very frisky flying airplane, and I just didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel safe in it, and it was uncomfortable, it was crowded.
Mm-hmm.
It was Mickey Mouse helicopters, what it was. They were very cheap to buy, you know?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good enough. Now, before you got hired, before you went out to Washington for your interview with, you said that was with George Duell.
Yes, General George Duell, down in Washington,
mm-hmm.
D.C.
And who, you said the chief pilot from Taipei?
Yes.
Yeah, he was there. Do you remember who that was?
Oh, give me a chance and I'll think of it.
Okay. If it pops into your mind, that's great.
Yeah, remind me of it.
Mm-hmm. What did you know before that interview? What did you know about Air America the air proprietaries, if you will, that were conducting operations in Southeast Asia? Did you know anything?
Not very much. You see, Andy wasn't there very long. Andy Commander Gluting wasn't there very long.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard mostly about the helicopter program, but he told me about the Beaver program, and he didn't know too much about it because it just started up when he left. But it was in support of Special Forces in Laos. And that's the program that I got hired for. And I was, strange enough, I was hired as an AirAsia pilot. And my contract states that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think probably most everybody else was. However, there was a little obscure clause in it that said that we could be loaned to Air America.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they did it. But I never saw my paycheck, so I just to this day don't know what was on my paycheck.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because it used to go directly to my bank.
Okay. And, let's see, what kind of briefings did you receive before you left the United States to go to Asia? Anything? After you were hired?
Not much, except the contract explained some things.
Mm-hmm.
But the big briefing I got was in Taipei.
Okay.
I took off from Kennedy Airport on Northwest Airlines. I was 25 years old, I think, and got off in Tokyo and switched to the Mandarin Jet, the Convair that Civil Air Transport had,
mm-hmm.
and they flew me down to Taipei, and then they put me in the Grand Hotel with several other people who were just hired, including Paul Quackenbush, who formed Empire Airlines from up in Utica, New York, and he grew that into quite an airline, sold it for $40 million to Piedmont, quite a success story, and he went to Yale, so he and I got along good because I lived in Wallingford, which is right near there,
mm-hmm.
and let's see. Then we went to ground school there for, I think it was a month.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a review of weight and balance and fuel consumption, and they explained to us about the conditions and Laos. And he told us that we'd have to learn the country with another pilot first for several hours, and that then we would be upgraded to captains in the Beaver.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the pilots were hired for the Helio program, as I recall, but I was hired for the Beaver program. But they put us all to the same ground school, and they gave us all kinds of problems to work on fuel consumption, even on DC-3s and C-46s. It was a very, really good program, and the gentleman who ran it was a very personable fellow. He was the chief pilot, and I still can't remember his name, but it'll come to me, though.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one that I met in Washington. And that was a nice experience. The hotel was nice, and I was on there. We had a crew bus. He used to pick us up every day, and one day Hugh Grundy was on there, and I didn't know who he was, and he just said to me, how do you like the program so far? And I said, boy, I really like it. I said the right things, but that's the way I felt about it. good thing I didn't say anything bad.
Yes, sir. Okay. Now, let me see. You know, to verify, you actually sent us the contract you signed, or the contract that they sent you in the letter form, dated 9 May 1962.
I sent it to you?
Yes, sir. Yeah,
I
have a copy of that.
I copy it for you.
Right.
Okay, good.
Your month at a monthly salary of $650.
Yeah, sounds right. Yeah.
Now,
that was good money back then.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. You know, that sounds like pretty good money, was it?
Yeah, we used to make a lot of overtime.
Mm-hmm.
One month, I made $3,600 back in 1962.
Wow.
That's when you could buy a cup of coffee for a nickel.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, did you understand at all that Laos was, at the time, hostile territory that you'd be flying and being shot at?
Of course, because Commander Gluding, back at the helicopter airline in Boston, explained it all to me. You know, he got shot down, spent 4 years in the jungle, four days in the jungle.
Right.
So, naturally.
Yep.
I understood the dangers.
Mm-hmm. What did your wife think of this?
Oh, she had a great time. Her family didn't like it, but she loved it.
Mm-hmm.
Great experience for her.
Mm-hmm.
We had in Laos, we had a French colonial house,
mm-hmm,
right near the airport,
mm-hmm,
and we had maid service and banana trees in the yard. It was all fenced in,
mm-hmm,
and it was just a beautiful house. And we only paid $100 a month, I think, back in those days, which is very inexpensive considering the kind of money I was making.
Mm-hmm.
However, in Udon, it wasn't so good. We had substandard housing there. Yeah, but we got along okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were very young, and all of a sudden we were making a lot of money, and so that sort of seemed to satisfy,
mm-hmm,
some things, and we could look the other way on things that weren't so comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And
well,
Udon, mm-hmm, Udon was okay, but Vientiane was better because it was kind of like an international city. You know, it had the embassy there, and we had the USAID complex there. However, Udon expanded a lot after that I left. I was only there a few months at Udon.
Mm-hmm.
And They had a school there and a lot more facilities than when I was there.
Uh-huh.
And a big club. But Vientiane was a much better experience.
Okay. Well, when you finished your ground school training in Taipei, where did you go from there?
Oh, let's see. They threw me on a DC-3, and they flew us. I remember being in Tainan. I don't remember how I got to Tainan, I'll be honest with you, but I do remember, yes, I think the airplane was flown to Tainan,
mm-hmm,
from Taipei, and I remember being in Tainan, where the U-2s were,
mm-hmm,
and they wouldn't let us look out the windows.
Okay.
It was an Air America DC-3,
uh-huh,
and then we flew to Hong Kong. We spent, it was my first night ever in Hong Kong, and I loved that. It was a very short stay there, but at least I got my feet wet there,
mm-hmm,
and I went there many times afterwards, but then we flew on to Da Nang, and for a fuel stop,
mm-hmm,
and it was quite a trip. I was sitting on bench seats in the back of the airplane with a bunch of other pilots, two or three, as I recall. There weren't many on there. At Da Nang, it was quite interesting to see the banana helicopters there from Fort Devens, mm-hmm, Massachusetts, because that was close to home.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to fly up to Fort Devens with the L-19s out of Hartford.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to some of the pilots there while we were getting refueled. And they were telling me how much they got shot at there and that the airplane really didn't, that the banana helicopter, I forget what that was called now, but it was built down in Philadelphia, I think. Would it be the H-21, I think? But anyway, it was a tandem rotor thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they were replaced by the Hueys because the Hueys had turbine engines that could operate a lot better in the mountains there in,
mm-hmm,
Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, I went on to Vientiane, and we landed at Vientiane, and I think we landed at Udon. Yes, we landed at Udon.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yes, because that's where I was being based. Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Then we landed at Udon.
Okay.
And then I started my my line checking with Captain Ferguson. He was the chief pilot of the Beaver program. And he took me all over the country on missions for the Special Forces, and I learned the country, and he cut me loose.
Okay. Now, when you were there at Da Nang for your refueling, and you noticed the banana helicopters and the base there, how much of a buildup was there? This is 62. So how much of a buildup?
Okay. No, this was like the Special Forces or advisory teams that have been in Vietnam since the mid-50s because Joe Pilastro, I mentioned before, became the commander of Force Guam, four-star general. I met him at flight school, and he was a first lieutenant, West Point graduate. He had already been to Vietnam, and this was in 1959 when we were in flight school. And he was an advisor there for 1 year.
Okay.
So that's what the military was there. They were there in support of South Vietnamese troops.
Right. Okay. And then when you moved on to Thailand, how large was the base there when you arrived?
Well, it was a very long runway there. It was 6,000-7,000 feet, maybe more. It was concrete. And the Air America facility was... it was fairly substantial then, but they expanded it a great deal after that I left. But it had big hangars and office building there for everybody, and Pat Landry had his office there, a separate building, and they had all kinds of antennas sticking up from it for his communications to whoever and wherever. And we had a club, but it was really a shabby, sort of a wooden structure. They built a really nice one after I left, though. I remember Rusty Phillips used to be the manager of the club, and I used to bring wine down from him, from Vien Chinh, French wine. And I used to bring it down and sell to him, you know, at cost. Although some people thought I was making some money on it, but I really wasn't.
Okay.
I just did it so that the guys there would have some nice wine from France.
Yeah.
And then they had a nice club there then, beautiful club. That was probably 64 that they had that up. So it was kind of primitive when I was there in Udon, but a lot of things changed as time went on, because that operation in Udon, it was over a decade.
And you said that when you first arrived there, you were taken on flights with the chief pilot?
Yes, Bob Ferguson, yes. About 100 hours it was.
Where were those flights principally?
All over Laos, up in the Van Hui Sai region, up to Phong Sali is the name of the place I was trying to think of before. That's way up north there that I told you about, where I used to run those missions up there. Right into China, and then up into Luang Prabang, and then down, all down along the Mekong River. There we used to make drops out of Savannah Ket, and the place that's between Savannah Ket and Vien Chinh. I can't remember the name right now. But then on down, we used to go down to Pak Sae and drop to the Special Forces on the Plateau de Bolawan, and then I did all that after that he checked me out. We used to get assigned to certain teams for a day or two, hauling them supplies, metal roofing, whatever they wanted. And on the weekends, we used to, on Sundays, they used to have a skydiving club, and we used to let them skydive up in Vien Chinh on Sundays. We used to do that for them, too.
Okay. What altitude?
Well...
Altitudes.
Believe it or not, I used to get the Beaver up to 19,000. And I, you know, the door was off, but I couldn't get up there with six jumpers on there. I used to kick them out in stages on the way up. And I think I used to get up to 19,000 with one jumper. And he would go out, and it was getting cold up there and short of oxygen. And so what I would do is throw the flaps down and cut the engine, put on the carburetor heat, and dive. And and they used to land in the rice paddies around Vien Chinh there. That was a great sport for those guys.
Yeah.
They were incredible guys.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
They were incredible guys. Fearless.
The guys that you would take up to 19,000, were they jumping on oxygen?
No.
Wow.
We weren't up there very long, you know?
Okay.
We were all young. We could do it.
Okay. That's pretty cool.
It used to get cold, even though they were in Laos, yeah.
Yeah. Now, did you yourself ever skydive?
No, I'm not nuts.
Okay.
Are you a skydiver?
Yeah, I was a paratrooper.
Okay. Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. I heard all the time. I've heard it quite a bit before. Anyway. As you were learning the area, would the chief pilot let you take over command of the aircraft to fly it around and stuff too?
Oh, I was in the right seat. I was flying. No, let's see. Yeah, I was in the right seat, Alder, but I do landings and takeoffs, yeah.
Mm-hmm, okay. And
he'd stay. No, wait a minute. Yeah, and he'd stay in the left seat, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he'd stay in the captain's seat.
Okay. And let's see, you did that for 100 hours. About how long did that take in terms of weeks or months?
A month.
1 month?
Yeah.
Okay.
There's a lot of territory to cover, you know?
Yes,
and
absolutely.
They didn't want to cut pilots loose up there and not knowing where the hell they were going.
Right.
Because it was dangerous.
Yes, sir. You mentioned that you were providing support for special forces. Now, is this what we think of special forces in terms of U.S. Army, Green Beret special forces, or were these the CIA case officers working with indigenous Lao forces?
Well,
the customers.
The customers, yes. Generally speaking, we were supporting directly special forces. However, there was a customer on once in a while.
Mm.
In Pakse, there was a customer there, but I think that they operate independently of each other.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't remember when I did all those flights in the Beavers. I don't ever remember going into Long Chen.
Okay.
And of course, you know, that's where the CIA major
yes.
hub was there.
Yes.
I didn't start going in there until I started working for Bird and Son. That's when I met Tony Poe and
mm-hmm.
and here we go. Another name that slipped my mind, but it'll come to me though.
Mm-hmm.
But that's when I started work directly for the CIA.
Okay. Now, for that first month that you were flying with the chief pilot, did you guys ever come under fire?
Oh, yeah, sure. Once friendly, we believe.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we were dropping north of that strip. It was a long dirt strip between Vientiane and Savannah Kett.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't think of the name of it right now. I think it was Lima 35.
Okay.
And we were just up in the boondocks a little ways dropping rice to some friendlies there, and we took a round in the fuel cell. And we figured it was some drunk Lao soldier, you know. But we never knew though. But
uh-huh.
the bullet ended up in the rice, and we just you know, we hauled ass out of there once we took the round. We didn't drop the rice,
mm-hmm.
and we lost the fuel in that cell. But other than that, you know, we made it back home okay.
Okay.
But that was my first round I took.
Uh-huh.
I took more later.
Uh-huh. What was the heaviest thing you were fired on during that first month?
During the first month?
Yeah.
Small arms.
It was all small arms?
Yeah.
Okay. And what were you typically dropping? Was it mostly food, rice, and you mentioned some building materials and things like that?
Well, during my checkout, as I recall, it was mostly rice.
Okay.
But it's been so long ago that there could have been other stuff, too. I just don't remember.
Did you drop many weapons and stuff like that? Ammunition?
No, I don't think that we dropped that kind of stuff from the Beaver. They were able to. We take it into the major hubs, like Pakse and Saravan and those places. Saravan is the name of the place I was thinking, trying to remember the name of, between Vientiane and Savannah Kett. It's Saravan, I think.
Okay.
And I think that real heavy stuff used to be taken in by DC-3s and C-123s and so forth, and it was disseminated from there. But it may have been dropped by somebody else. But generally speaking, we didn't carry that kind of stuff, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
But you got to remember, it's a long time ago.
Oh, absolutely.
So I would say no. It was, but we used to carry a lot of. I'd carry a lot of soda pop and food supplies,
mm-hmm.
and a little bit of beer once
mm-hmm.
in a while,
mm-hmm.
and medical supplies, I said,
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing, and also moving the special forces back and forth to their hubs along the river
mm-hmm.
and along Pabong and so forth, mm-hmm. that sort of a thing.
Okay. Now, the guys that you'd carry, the special forces guys, were they in uniform?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Okay.
Great bunch of guys.
Yeah. Do you know what group they were with?
Yes, I do. White Star.
Okay.
And before I got there, they were commanded by Bull Simon.
Mm-hmm.
And the commander, when I got there,
mm-hmm.
I got a nice letter from him. I
mm-hmm.
think you have it there.
Mm-hmm.
Was Colonel Meredith. No, Major Meredith then.
Okay. And this, you said, they were part of Operation White Star.
Correct. It was White Star, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you know about how many outposts they had?
Six, eight.
Okay.
Six or eight. Let's see. They had one at Pakse, one at Savannah Kett. one at Tocat, I think, and then they had one at Saravan, Luang Prabang, and Ban Hui Sai. And there may have been a couple more that I've forgotten about that were maybe out in the, where there was no airstrip, and that they used to get dropped to, and maybe I never aided them at all. I just can't recall.
Okay. And how many men were typically at one of these locations? Do you remember?
Probably a dozen.
Okay.
Oh, I remember there was a base also at Siaburi.
Okay.
For the Special Forces.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see here. So, after your first month of flying with the chief pilot, what was it like your first time out by yourself?
In a beaver program, it was great to get rid of him,
mm-hmm.
like any instructor,
right.
And be on my own. And it was just a really very challenging job, and it was just fun to fly those beavers in and out of those strips and move the special forces around. And like I said, they're a great country, bunch
mm-hmm.
of guys who were fun to fly with. And it was just very challenging and dangerous at times, but enjoyed doing it. Enjoyed socializing with them at their bases.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we couldn't because the base was like in down at Pak Sae. The base was up in the Plateau de Bolivar, so we couldn't land up there.
Mm-hmm.
But we used to drop them off in Pak Sae, and they'd go up by jeep or something.
Okay.
But it was a great experience, and the money factor, of course, was interesting too.
Mm-hmm.
That was a great motivation for me. But it was an incredible experience. It was the most exciting part of my aviation career. No doubt about it.
Well, what was your average day like, and how much time would you spend up country?
In the beaver program, very little. We used to come back to Udon almost every night.
Okay.
But sometimes we could fly as much as 10, 12 hours
mm-hmm.
of flight time, hard time.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be, a 13, 14-hour day. But we just kept moving, you know, because they wanted things moved.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's the old slogan, you call, we haul, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir.
And boy, we hauled a lot.
Now, what markings were on your aircraft?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm glad you brought that up. I'll run that by you. They were Army beavers. It was obvious to me because of the markings in them. What they did is they took the paint off to get rid of the 50 pounds of paint, because that's 50 pounds of payload.
Mm-hmm.
And the markings on the tails began with L, like in Lima.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had like 201, 202, 203, 204, 205, 206, 207, 208. I think those were the tail numbers.
Okay.
It may not be exactly right on the beginning and the last one, but that's pretty close.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. They took the Army Beavers had a lot of radio gear in them for ILS and UHF and FM. And they took all of that out, and they stripped it down to get more weight out of the airplane, and they strictly had a VHF-HF in it. And I think we still had, I think they even took the VORs out, because we didn't have any VORs over there, but it was basically an ADF and dead reckoning operation. But maybe the VORs were still in, I can't remember. But I do know that they stripped them down of a lot of the avionics that the Army would use, but that we couldn't use in Laos, because they had nobody to talk to, and nothing to navigate with. That's pretty much covers what they did with the beavers,
mm-hmm.
but they're obviously on loan from the U.S. Army.
Okay. Now, and what about your uniforms? What did you wear? What kind of markings were on your uniforms? Headgear, things like that.
It was a standard Air America uniform.
Okay.
It was gray, as I recall, and we had a hat that we wore. I think
mm-hmm.
it was kind of like a cowboy hat, not leather, lightweight,
mm-hmm.
to keep the sun from beating on our heads, I guess, and just to make us look more airline, paramilitary, whatever they want us to look like,
mm-hmm.
organized, I guess.
Yeah.
It was supposed to be a clandestine airline, but it sure didn't operate like one.
Okay. Well, you knew that you were working for the CIA.
Yeah, sure I did.
Okay.
Yeah.
State
Department came around, checked me out in my neighborhood after I left.
Okay.
In Wallingford,
mm-hmm.
they came around. They asked all kinds of questions about me. And they said that they were from the DOD.
Mm-hmm.
But what can I tell you? You know, they were really from the agency.
Yeah. Okay. Basically, doing the background investigation.
Exactly.
On
yeah. yeah. I'm sure they went up and talked to the National Guard about me and all that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see. And well, I guess why don't you go ahead and describe some of the more memorable trips you made up country during that June, July, August, 5 month period that you were flying by yourself.
One of them was a trip that I made from Udorn in the Beaver in support of the Special Forces down to Pak Say.
Mm-hmm.
It was a pretty long trip, three and a half hours, I think, if I recall correctly. Maybe 3 hours. And I would not only be hauling supplies and Special Force people, but I ended up one day with a fellow by the name of Ed Hall. And he was a new case officer for Pak Say for the agency. And he quit Northeast Airlines out of Boston to go to work for the agency. And he spent a couple of years down there, and he went back with Northeast Airlines afterwards. But I got to know him, and I bumped into him up in at school at Northeast Airlines after I left in 67. Yeah, I went to work for Northeast Airlines in 1967. I bumped into him in the school up there in Winthrop, Massachusetts, outside the airport there at Logan. So that was an interesting experience. Let's see, what else? I can't remember anything else that was other than routine in the Beaver program, because it didn't last that long, you know. And the Beaver program was terminated in 1962 as a result of the Geneva Accords, where all U.S. forces and U.S. involvement and Air America were withdrawn from Laos. So what in the final days of the operation, and the job was to for us guys to go with the Beavers and pull all those guys out, and I pulled the team out in Pak Say. And I remember one of the last things that we did is the Special Forces had me fly over the boulevards and take a lot of photographs of the boulevards, because they said if they had to go back in there, then they would they'd have to jump in there, and then they wanted good photos of that. So I did that for them. And I'm sure that all the Special Forces were pulled out of Laos. I'm absolutely sure of it, because I know all the guys who did it. But I'm also sure that the North Vietnamese regulars didn't pull out like they were supposed to, too.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what closed up the Beaver program.
Okay.
And I was out of work.
Well, you mentioned that there was also a POW, a captured Vietnamese.
That was after I went to work for Byrd.
Oh, okay, that was later. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, with the end of the Beaver program, as far as you were understood things, was that supposed to indicate, were the Geneva Accords concerning Laos supposed to indicate a complete ending of all activity in Laos as far as the
CIA? Yeah, they formed a neutralist government, which, mm-hmm. which didn't work, of course, you know.
Yes.
So things, Air America couldn't fly in there into Laos anymore
mm-hmm.
because of the Accords,
mm-hmm.
but they used to bring stuff up to the border in Thailand
mm-hmm.
From Tak Lee and Bangkok or wherever they brought it from. And then Byrd and Son would be waiting there with their DC-3s.
Mm-hmm.
And they would, and then because in the Geneva Accords, then Byrd and Son could still fly in Laos.
Okay.
So that Byrd and Son started to fly supplies up in the Laos because that they were fighting up there again. And the CIA case officers were up there managing the supplies and training soldiers again. That was like the Geneva Accords were in October, and that was early 63.
Okay. But as far as you understood, all of the Operation White Star Special Forces personnel had been pulled out.
That's correct. I don't remember them going back in either, to be
okay.
honest with you.
Okay.
They might have, but I didn't interface with them, because then I was working up at Long Chen strictly for Tony Poe and Vinnie Lawrence.
Okay. And so it really did, at this point, become a complete, as far as the Laos operation, it appears it was mostly CIA-run. In a covert operation.
After the Special Forces left, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So how did you get, when you were out of work in October of 62, what did you do?
Well, Bob Ruslow was Vice President of Operations, and I met him in Taipei, and I was interviewed by him. I was already hired, but he kind of like gave me a rundown of what was going on down there, and he said, he says, you know, we'll probably get a lull in this war at some time. Things will slow down. And he says, but don't worry, the communists will stir up again, and we'll have a lot of flying to do. So I decided that I'd stay in Bangkok for a while. My wife and I got a nice apartment down there, and we enjoyed Bangkok. And then we decided nothing was going to happen, so I returned home, got my twin-engine rating up in Barrington, Massachusetts, in the Berkshires.
Mm-hmm.
And then I kept sending resumes to Dutch Brongers at the Bird & Son, Bird Air. I told them I had experience in Laos and that I got my light twin license now and I had so many more hours and all that. Finally got a telegram from Bird & Son Construction Company in Seattle, and they sent me a ticket, and away I went again.
Okay.
So I went back to, then at that time I went to Vientiane, and I remember that very clearly because I was flown into Udorn,
mm-hmm.
and somehow, I can't remember how, but I ended up in Nong Khai, and the CIA arranged for me to be wetbacked into Laos in a canoe across the Mekong River, some kind of a small boat.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my... That was the way that I legally or illegally got into Laos, working for Bird & Son.
Okay. Now, how long did you stay in Bangkok before you came back to the U.S.?
Oh, I guess 5-6 weeks.
Okay. Very long. Very short time.
Yeah, not very long, yeah.
And when did you get your twin engine rating?
Oh, it was in the winter of maybe January 63.
Okay, so very early 63.
Somewhere in that. Maybe have been November. No, it wouldn't be in November because I was still in Bangkok. Probably January 63.
And then when did you find yourself back in Southeast Asia?
Probably February, March.
Wow. Very quick turnaround.
Pardon?
Very quick turnaround.
Yeah, it did take long because the communists started acting up again. You know?
Right. Now, what did you understand at this point as you're going back for your second tour, if you will, with Bird & Son? What did you understand the United States was trying to accomplish in Southeast Asia?
What were we supposed to accomplish?
What was the United States trying to accomplish in Southeast Asia?
Oh, the United States was trying to accomplish keeping a peace in Laos and keeping a government that was not expansion-oriented and a government that was peaceful and one that would prosper for the Laotian people,
mm-hmm.
and one that would keep communism in North Vietnam.
What were you going to fly for Bird & Son? Or what did you fly when you went back?
Well, I started out as a co-pilot on the C-46s with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that for 2 months, and then they checked me out in the Dornier, the light twin Dornier. And I flew that for 2,200 hours for them.
2,200 hours?
Yeah. But then I also flew the Pioneer.
Mm-hmm.
I got between 3,000 and 4,000 hours in Laos during that tour with Air America Bird Air and Continental. I got between 3,000 and 4,000 hours in Laos and
mm-hmm.
Vietnam and the combat areas.
Okay. And when you say Continental, you're talking about CASI, right?
Yes, Continental Air Services, subsidiary of Continental Airlines.
Right.
Run by Pierre Salinger.
Mm-hmm. Let's go ahead and talk about your first couple of months flying with Bird & Sons. And
okay.
the C-46 as a co-pilot. After you got into country, where were you principally stationed out of, and what were the types of missions you were flying?
Vientiane, it was airdrops.
Okay.
And one of the guys that I flew with used to fly the hump.
Really?
Yeah, Duffy Buller.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, he was the pilot of a C-46 you were flying, though.
Oh, yeah, I was the new kid on the block.
Right.
Yeah, he was
the
old pro.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Did he tell you many stories about flying the hump?
No, I don't think so.
No?
No. I just knew that he flew the hump.
Okay. Did you meet many other pilots that had that kind of experience in World War II?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Eric Schilling
mm-hmm.
was my chief pilot at Bird, and he was a flying Tiger ace.
Wow.
I read one of the books on him, and he's been written in many books, and...
Mm-hmm.
He was considered the hottest ace in flying for the Flying Tigers out of Burma. It was 1939 when he was, I think it was 19 or something like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you ever meet Felix Smith?
No, but I heard that name many, many times.
Okay.
I don't think I met him. I think he was flying for CAT.
Mm-hmm. He sure was.
I may have just met him in passing, but I think I have his book, too.
Mm-hmm.
But he was like in a different part of the company. I was
yes.
flying out of Taipei.
Right. Okay. Now, the missions that you were flying out of Vientiane with C-46s, resupply drops, mostly food, or do they and other supplies, or medical supplies, things like that, or did this work also involve more ammunition and weapons drops?
What we called hard rice,
right.
But a lot of rice, a lot of real rice.
A lot of real rice.
Yeah, it was on pallets, and I forget how many pallets it was now, but it was on rollers, and the kickers used to cut them loose and let them slide out the door, and they would be parachuted. But we dropped buffalo meat too. No, we didn't do that. I used to see Air America dropping the live buffaloes in the cages,
uh-huh.
And they would hit the ground, and it was meat for the troops, of course, and they would hit the ground, and they would break their legs, but they were slaughtered right there on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
They dropped them out of the C-123s because they had the aft sliding door. It was easy to roll them out.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't do that out of a C-46. They were too big.
The water buffalo were?
Yes.
Yeah. And I'm sorry, I say water buffalo. I'm assuming water buffalo.
Yeah, water buffalo, yeah.
Okay.
I was trying to think of the Thai name for them, but it's
uh-huh.
my mind now.
I forgot to ask you, how much could you carry with the beavers, approximately?
Let's see. Probably about 700 pounds, 800 pounds.
Okay.
Depending on how much fuel we had on board, you know.
Uh-huh. How about I'm sorry?
Beaver had a tremendous range because it had the wingtip tanks.
Okay. How about with the C-46?
Oh, I can't remember those figures. I think the C-46 was gross at 50,000, but
mm-hmm.
you can't hold me to that.
Okay. Yes, considerably more.
Pardon?
Considerably more.
It is?
Compared to the Beaver.
Oh, yeah. The C-46 was a big airplane.
Yeah, huge.
Transport.
Yeah. Okay. And what parts of Laos were you flying when you were during that first couple of months as a co-pilot?
The C-46?
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. It was up, we used to go way up north. Fong Soli, I think it was the drop, and it was trips up north of Vientiane. I don't ever remember going down into the southern part of Laos.
Mm-hmm.
However, some of the planes used to go down there, but I don't ever remember going down there. But one trip was very interesting. I was with the Merck Bassler.
Mm-hmm.
Merck was a tremendous pilot and tremendous individual, and he helped me a lot with the C-46 because he was highly experienced in it. We're up north of Luang Prabang, and we just finished our drop, probably an hour and a half north of Luang Prabang, and we're on our way back to Vientiane. And all of a sudden, one of the engines started to leak oil very, very badly. And he said to me, he says, Jim, he says, you know, you're part of this crew too. And this really impressed me that a guy would do this, you know, because a lot of guys wouldn't do this. Because he was the captain, he said, "Jim, he says, you know, we have a serious problem with that engine. We may lose that engine." He says, "It's entirely up to you. You want to land at LP, or you want to go on to, or do you want to take the chance to go on to Vientiane with this problem?" And I says, "Captain Bassler, it's entirely up to you." I says, "You know, it's your call." And so then we lost the engine, so he had to go to LP. So losing the engine made the decision for him. So we landed there on one engine, and they sent the crew up, and they put a new engine on it, and somebody else flew it out. That was an exciting day for me.
did you have to handle the aircraft at all, or did he take care of that?
Oh, no, he did all that. No,
yeah.
I wouldn't even try that.
Okay.
Single engine on that big airplane.
Uh-huh.
At my level of experience, no way.
Okay. Let's see. How much were you fired upon during that first couple of months there with the C-46s?
I don't ever remember being fired upon, but we may have, but I don't. We never took a round that I can remember of.
Okay.
Because, you know, C-46 flew high, and
mm-hmm.
the only time that we'd be likely to take a round is during a drop.
Mm-hmm.
And I just never, don't ever remember taking a round in a C-46.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead and describe the Flight Information Center. And I meant to ask you about that during your first tour with Air America. In 62, and I forgot to. So if you would,
I sent the whole brochure down to you.
Yeah, but if you would, could you describe what you remember most about the briefing system and how effective you thought it was?
I thought it was very, very effective, and they had really decent people in there. Bill Solon was running it, and he had another fellow there who worked with him too.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember his name now, but he's in the Air America directory. I think he's living up around Washington State now, and he was very good too. And we used to go in the morning if we were going into a strange area, and they used to tell us what they knew about the enemy up there. And of course, if we knew that there was a strong possibility of getting shot or shot down, then we wouldn't go there.
Okay. Did that change at all from your first tour in 62 to your time in 63 with Bird Air?
I don't think there was any such thing as 62.
Oh, there wasn't?
No, I don't think so. But I think that document that I sent you may explain that to you.
Well, yeah, I'm looking at it now. It's basically a short history.
Mm-hmm. However, it's possible that I never used it in the Beaver program because we were based in Udon, and that Flight Information Center was in Vientiane.
Okay.
But I don't think that it was formed until 63.
Mm-hmm.
But,
when that C-46 was shot down.
Now, which one?
It talks in this history of the Flight Information Center, it talks about a C-46 being shot down, the pilot and co-pilot, five other crew members.
That was outside of Savannah Cat, wasn't it? That was the...
Doesn't say specifically the location.
Oh, the pilot went to school with me, had a French name.
Mm.
I'll try to think of that, too.
Okay, so the briefings you got before your missions in 1962, were you told... Where not to fly at all? I mean, what could be hostile areas?
1962?
Right. During your time with Air America flying the Beavers.
Oh, of course we were. I don't recall specifics on it, but
okay.
Any time we had a mission, it was into where there were special forces
mm-hmm.
or whether they knew where there were Laotian soldiers that were there and it was safe to drop stuff, yeah. But, sometimes places get overrun and whatnot, but... I don't remember that happening to me with the Beaver.
Mm-hmm. Okay. While we're talking about that document that you sent to us, T.C. Walker, do you remember what his initials stand for? The guy that wrote this?
No, I don't.
Okay. Just curious. Okay, so when you went to work with Bird and Son and you started flying first the C-46s and then the Dorniers, What kind of briefings did you get? How effective were they?
The briefings were very effective. We used to go over the Flight Information Center
mm-hmm.
if we were going into an area that we didn't know about.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we used to get briefed up by Tony Poe
okay.
up at Long Chen all the time, too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes he would have more recent information than the Flight Information Center,
okay.
and he would pass it on back to them.
Mm-hmm.
It was a combined effort of people, you know, the pilots coming in and giving information and information coming in from outer posts.
Mm-hmm.
They had an extensive communication network there.
Yes, sir.
With the Chinese fellows and all the towers at all these bases, and communication was quite good, especially for way back in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, did I answer your question?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Now, you mentioned that before we started recording the second section of the interview, that you worked with Tony Poe. He's been talked about a lot. And covered in some of the literature about the work in Laos. Just out of curiosity, what do you remember most about him personally, you, from your interaction and experience with him?
With Tony?
Yes, sir.
Oh, he was great.
Uh-huh.
It was fun to work with him.
Mm-hmm.
He's gung-ho.
Okay.
He was concerned for our safety,
mm-hmm.
but he's given us a lot of work, and he was just a lot of fun to work with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of his effectiveness... as far as your understanding of what was going on in that part of the country, how effective did you think he was?
With what he had to work with, he was extremely effective.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall any particular stories or incidents with Tony Poe that you would share with us or would want to share with us?
Not really. I just know that he lost a finger. I wasn't with him, but he lost a finger from a hand grenade or a booby trap or something. That you probably got that story already. But he was a very dynamic guy.
Mm-hmm.
He was in the Tibetan airlift, and
mm-hmm.
I think he was in a war in Indonesia and World War II as a Marine. And,
yes, sir.
If there was a war out there, then he was involved in it. Korea, I think he was involved in Korea, too.
Yes, sir.
Just an incredible guy.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that you also worked quite a bit with Vinnie Lawrence
this
time.
Vinnie Lawrence was there for the 3 years that I flew out of Long Chen.
Okay.
And as was Tony Poe.
Okay. I guess this when you transitioned from the C-46 to the Dornier, why don't you go ahead and describe what that was like and what your missions were?
I don't remember who checked me out in the Dornier. Didn't take very long, though,
because
it was a light airplane. And I already had experience flying upcountry, so I didn't have to be taught the country. I would go up to, I would take supplies up to Tony at Long Chen, and then he would assign me missions all day long, all through central Laos. And I would drop supplies, maybe move troops, or drop supplies, or land with supplies on all of the strips upcountry, many of them.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the missions that was flying people. Up into China. I used to drop them off and go pick them up a week later. And of course, Tony denies all this, but I always figured they were spies under the cloak of carrying in medicine. They were locals, but I figured they were up there spying on what was going on up there.
Mm-hmm. Into China.
Yes, it was in China, not very far, but it was definitely in China.
Now, were you dropping or landing?
I was landing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was spooky.
were these just open areas and fields, or were they cleared specifically for this purpose?
It was a typical strip that they cut out for us. It was
a dirt
mm-hmm. strip, and mm-hmm. it wasn't very long.
Mm-hmm.
But I used to fly the Dornier, and I think I might have used to fly the Pioneer in there too, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
But I know I flew the Dornier. I think it was only Dorniers, and I used to fly up to the Fong Sali with the Dorniers too.
Mm-hmm. What was the payload of that aircraft?
Probably 800 pounds.
And how many passengers could you carry?
Let's see. I think I could carry about six.
Okay.
Yeah.
How many? Do you recall about how many trips you went up into southern China?
Probably five or six.
Okay. And you said that this was under the guise of medical, providing medical supplies and stuff?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you ever carry any Americans?
No.
Okay.
We used to take Americans to Fong Sali, which is pretty close to there.
Mm-hmm.
That's way up in the northern part near China.
Mm-hmm.
That was a risky operation, so we'd fly up there, and we used to have to check in an hour before landing, and they'd say, continue the mission or abort. That's how touchy it was.
Wow.
And I remember Dutch Brongers was up there one day, and he was in a Dornier from Bird Air, and Al Rich was up there. He was, and I went through school with him too out there in Taipei. Al Rich,
mm-hmm.
and he was up there with a Helio, and they wouldn't let him go.
Hmm.
And Dutch said Dutch wouldn't leave until they let him go. And somehow Dutch was a very persuasive guy. Been out there to Asia for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Great personality, and he was able to talk them into letting him go. So they both flew out of there. That's how touchy that place was.
Oh.
It was scary. I didn't like going in there, but plus it was up high on a hill.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very, it used to rain up there, and if you slid off the end of the runway, then you'd drop 2,000-3,000 feet. It wasn't one of the best places that we had to go to.
How long was the runway?
Probably 1,500 feet long. But, you know, when it was muddy up there, Jesus, you know, you had to get in there.
1,500 feet long.
Yeah, and you had to get in there in the first 100 feet.
Mm-hmm.
If it was dry, no problem.
Right. My goodness. Now, when you were flying up into that area, not over into China, but in the very northernmost part of Laos, were those typically personnel drops or also material?
Well, when I used to fly the Dornier, it was material and people.
Uh-huh.
But we used to make airdrops. I used to make airdrops with a Pioneer around Fong Sli, south of Fong Sli, as I remember.
Mm-hmm.
We used to do a lot of that up there with the Pioneer. We dropped rice and supplies.
Yeah. Now, how were the Bird and Sun aircraft marked?
I think that the EC-3s, it was a combination.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah, it's coming back to me now. One Dornier had that I brought back from the factory. It had an N number with an American flag on it, and it had American, it was a German airplane with American engines.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the flights that we had was from a guy from New Zealand. His name was Len Cooper. And this was after the neutral government was covered. And one of the cabinet members, who was a communist, came out, and we were going to give him a ride somewhere. And he went out and he looked at the airplane. And he says, American flag, New Zealand pilot, German airplane, American engines. I'm not going to go on that airplane.
Oh,
one of the more humorous times we had out there. We had a lot of humorous times out there.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see.
But typically,
yeah, we used to drop with the Pioneer up in the upper part. But the C-46s used to go up there, and the DC-3s used to drop in that whole northern region up there.
Okay. Now, but typically, the aircrafts did have civilian markings?
Oh, yeah. That one had American registration on it in November. It was a 85 X-ray.
Mm-hmm.
And but some of them had Laotian registries on them.
Okay.
X-ray whiskey. And one of them was, one of the Dorneys was X-ray Whiskey Tango Bravo Juliet. And I think the other three Dorneys were Laotian registry. Air America's airplanes had the Bravo tail on them. They were Chinese Taiwan registry. However, some had N registrations on them.
Mm-hmm.
That pretty much covers that. The Beavers were nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Lima, what are that stood for?
Right. Did any of the other aircraft you flew in Southeast Asia ever, were they ever sanitized of their markings completely except for, say, just like a Lima designator, like with the Beavers? Or were they all typically marked in normal civilian markings?
They were civilian markings, yeah, but there were a lot of airplanes that were sanitized that would show up at various places at bigger airplanes,
mm-hmm.
you know, that they changed the tail numbers on.
Right.
But I can't give any details on that, but we know they were doing that all the time, you know.
Right. How about false flag operations?
Oh, first of all, the helicopters were marked H with a two-numeral designation, H-23 and H-22.
Mm-hmm.
And, maybe that's wrong. You probably know that already. Hotel H-E would be one, I think. I think it was only letters, but they didn't have an actual country registration on them.
Okay.
That's the best way to describe it to you.
Okay.
Because I know we used to call the helicopter that went down north of Vientiane, it was H-E, so it was shot down up there, and that's where they caught the Air America pilot and Grant Wolfking. Grant Wolfgang or Wolfking? Mm-hmm. Wolfkill, maybe. He was a reporter. And they shot them down up north of Vientiane just before you go in the mountains, and that spot we always called Hotel Echo because that was the registration of the helicopter.
Okay. Now, while you were flying in Laos for the entire time, going back to 62 and then later when you went back in 63 and after, how many SAR operations were either Air America or Burton Sun supporting that you were aware of?
How many? What kind of?
Search and rescue.
Lots of them. Many.
Mm-hmm. What pilots were they picking up? What kinds of pilots?
Military pilots.
U.S. military pilots.
Yeah, fighter pilots,
mm-hmm.
or reconnaissance pilots,
mm-hmm.
that were being shot down.
What kind of recon do you recall?
Yeah, the Navy used to run those recon planes through there, and the guy who escaped. He was a lieutenant in the Navy. He was flying a recon airplane over, not the plane du jour, but the one up north of there, I believe. No, it was the plane du jour,
mm-hmm.
I think. And he was shot down in a recon plane flying low.
Mm-hmm.
And he bailed out, I guess, and Tom Moore tried to go in to pick him up. And he picked up 83 bullet holes in his H-34.
Oh, my goodness.
And Bill Cook was behind him with another H-34, and... Klossman was his name. And Klossman knew that what was happening because the Pathet Lao put out a phony marker.
Mm-hmm.
That's what sucked Tom in. And he was trying to wave Tom off.
Oh, no.
And Tom didn't see him. But he knew he was right there. But then Tom was able to fly out, and Bill Cook aborted naturally. He had to.
Because mm-hmm.
they really tore up Tom's machine. It's a wonder that he made it back.
Mm-hmm.
And that was such a... had such a devastating effect on Tom that he was ex-Navy helicopter pilot, that what he did is he wouldn't fly up north anymore. He transferred to Bangkok, and he flew an Air America helicopter around Thailand for, I think it was for Just Mag.
Okay.
But then Klossman escaped 2 months later. I think you probably got that story already.
How about successful search and rescue?
Pardon?
Successful search and rescue missions.
How successful?
No, yeah. Did you yourself go on any successful SAR missions?
Well, yes, and no. You know, you find a pilot is killed, and how successful is that? I guess
I'm
it's successful because we find the body.
Right.
But I had one with Vinnie Lawrence on board, and I've written those all up in those letters to.
Yeah, Mr. Castle.
Yes, the Timothy Castle.
Right.
But one was way up north there, and it was an F-105, I think, and we found the aircraft. And I found it was in a clump of jungle,
mm-hmm.
surrounded by some plains in a valley.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it because of the smoke. And then then I called in the helicopters, Air America, and they went down and they pulled the body out and whatever else that they wanted to get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And another one was. I was looking for a guy, a Marine fighter pilot, who ran out of gas coming down from runs on the plane de jour, and I knew approximately where he popped out, but I didn't have the homing device in my I think I was in a Dornier, and we didn't have that capability, but I searched for him anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
I knew about where he was. And I looked and I looked, but I called in a C-123 that was airborne, because they had that homing device to pick up the beeper from a downed pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And they went overhead right away, and they found him right away.
Okay.
So I was involved in that, but and then the Air Force came up with a Husky, and they pulled the guy out. He was alive,
mm-hmm.
and they pulled him out with a Husky with a winch. He was hanging from a tree. And let's see, what was the other one? I've written up another one there. You got it all there, though. There was another one I was for. Oh, yeah, the other one was two T-28 U.S. Air Force pilots
mm-hmm.
took off from Vientiane, and they were going to Da Nang. Oh, this was a biggie for me, a biggie.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent, they did a massive search for these guys, and they gave us all a sector. And I was up in a Dornier, and Bill Donovan came along with me as my co-pilot and observer. And my major sector was about 30 miles of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And the USS Ticonderoga supported me. They were out in the Gulf of Tonkin. And they would send four ADs to... I flew 3 days, 7 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
And these ADs would... I'd have two on each wing. And they would follow me all down the Ho Chi Minh Trail all the time I was looking. But my sector was not only the Ho Chi Minh Trail, but a lot of other area. And on top of that, I didn't see them, but I was told there was a tanker and F-105s.
Mm-hmm.
And there was also an albatross that stuck with me for the 3 days that was the control ship. Well, I had a problem with the control ship because I couldn't talk to them. I could talk to the control ship, who would talk to the AD when I wanted to send them a message.
Mm-hmm.
And but the interesting thing is that as I pulled them down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, looking for the wrecks of these two T-28s, there was nothing there. I could see where the gun emplacements were, but everybody went to the jungle.
Mm.
And then up the trail, maybe 20 miles on one of those SARs, then I could see smoke. So I said, okay, guys, let's go up there and see what the smoke is. Get up there, nothing. No sign of any kind of life, human, animal, or anything. They were just... Because I say it's because I had those ADs on my wings. If it wasn't for them ADs, I probably wouldn't be around today.
Mm.
And they could probably hear the jets upstairs too.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an incredible. That was a biggie for me, and that's where the letter came from. I think for General Moore.
Yes, sir.
And let's see. And we heard 5 weeks later, 6 weeks later. It was a massive search. I was not the only one. There were other guys covering other sectors. We heard later on that they were found 6 weeks, 5 weeks later,
mm-hmm.
on the backside of a mountain outside of Da Nang. They were flying too low in weather, and they crashed. That's what happened to them.
Wow.
Two of them in formation. But it was quite an experience being supported off the USS Ticonderoga when the pilots, well, those guys had to leave me. And they'd send a message to me, say, you know, it's bingo time. So sorry, Jim. We'll see you later.
Mm-hmm.
They'd go back to the carrier.
Mm-hmm.
And but then I used to go search even without those guys. And I went to some real boony areas out there. But there was nobody out there except shacks and just isolated people out there. But I kept looking. I didn't necessarily need those guys with me, except over the trail. That's where I was really concerned. And it was really nice to have them over the trail.
Well, speaking of the trail, what do you remember about the trail network back in 62 when you were flying for flying the beavers?
Nothing flying the beavers, because I don't... Jerry was his name, mm-hmm. Prudhomme, Jerry Prudhomme. He was the guy who was shot down in the Air America C-46 that we were talking about. I think it was him, and he was shot down over on the trail, I think, east of Savannah Kett somewhere. It's kind of hazy, though, and I mean, it might be wrong. But I think that's the C-46 that you're talking about, and that's why the information group there was formed in Vientiane. But I really, we didn't fly near the Ho Chi Minh Trail in the Beavers. We were mainly supporting the Special Forces, and they weren't on the Ho Chi Minh Trail. They may have gone over there in Special Ops, but they certainly weren't asking for support over there.
Okay.
Unless they got support from somebody else.
Did you remember hearing about it during your first tour in 62?
Hearing about what?
The trail.
Oh, of course, yeah. The Ho Chi Minh Trail was famous, yeah.
And how about when you first started flying with Bert and Son, and as you've started flying more missions near the trail, what did it look like from the air from what you could see?
Well, we normally wouldn't go near the trail, except that three-day thing that I had looking for those downed T-28 pilots. And the trail was like a road through these little villages out in the boondocks. And like I say, there were villages there, but there was villages and gun emplacements. The guns were gone, the people were gone. And that went on for, I probably flew up and down the trail 7 to 10 hours, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Of the 21 hours that I spent on that three-day mission.
Okay.
Can you hold on a second?
Yes, sir. Now, besides the hazards of being shot at, what were some of the other flying challenges to flying in Laos?
Well, it was probably more hazardous landing on some of those strips than it was to getting shot at. However, later on, I think they started getting SAMs after I left, and I think they started to get more powerful anti-aircraft equipment in there, maybe 50-caliber machine guns, which they didn't have before when I was there. It became more dangerous at that point. I think that they started doing a lot of night flying, but I rarely flew at night there at all. when I was there, it was mostly daytime missions, but sometimes we would come back a little bit after dark, but I wouldn't go launch on the mission at 11 o'clock at night and go anywhere, you know, that sort of thing. So that's it was challenging being able to land on those strips because they were so short. One of them was like, that was Delta, it's like 15, that was like a roller coaster, you know. You'd land and you'd go downhill a little bit and then you'd go way up high and you'd land up on the top of it, and that was another spot where if you missed, you're going to fall off a cliff. As a matter of fact, they had an accident there with a caribou.
Mm-hmm.
Got all banged up there.
Okay. What about some of the various weather conditions or other phenomena, like the smoky season, stuff like that?
Oh, that was very interesting. The smoky season lasted for 2 months, and that was a very, very stressful period. I was flying the Pioneer one smoky season, and it was like I was on instruments all day long, you know. I could be at 8,000 feet, 5,000 feet. I couldn't see the ground. And I couldn't see ahead of me because it was black. It was daylight, but it was basically black, and I'd have to stay on the gauges. And it got especially tricky when it would get cloudy. So you really had to know where you were, and you really had to plan very carefully to get to your drop zone. And then of course there was the wet season, and the wet season was hazardous because of the strips. The strips were very bad. Matter of fact, I remember taking off with a brand new Dornier up at Sam Tong for Pop Buell and running a short mission for him. And it was a new airplane, and it still had the skirts on the wheels. And I'm trying to take off, and Sam Tong was like up on a hill, and there was a little slope down, and then it flattened out, and you could go. And I'm trying to take off, and I'm going down a hill, and I'm saying, this thing won't take off. And I don't understand. I was just sliding down the hill, you know. So I pulled it over to the side and got out and checked it out. And the wheels were packed full of mud in the skirts. And the wheels wouldn't turn. And that's a good, so we had to take the skirts off, and then the mud would fall away.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good example of one of the problems of the mud that was there during the rainy season. Plus, it was slippery, and
mm-hmm.
you know, you needed to be very, very careful.
That's amazing.
And then there was the dry season. That was great.
Mm-hmm.
No clouds. It was dry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No rain. It was just, you could see for miles and miles, and that lasted for months.
Okay. Now, were there any other field improvisations of the aircraft that you had to make because most of the aircraft were really designed for civilian activity, and you were applying them to military problems? Was there, you know, like the flaps, the wheel flaps, was there anything else that you had to do to the aircraft over time to make them better or easier to use in the environment?
No, except try to get the weight out, unnecessary equipment, to so that they could carry more.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I can think of for as of right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
You mentioned Pop Buell.
Yep.
How well did you get to know him? What do you remember about him?
Pop Buell, I got to know very well, and I really admire what that man did and what his call was. He's just an incredible individual.
Any particular memories of certain operations and other things that you might have done with him?
Pop Buell was a humanitarian, and he wasn't so much interested in the war. But he was there, his call was there to help the people, and he worked for USAID. But he used to interface with Tony Poe across the mountain there in the other valley. And he would get support from Tony when he needed airplanes, and he would get support from Vientiane, from USAID, when he needed them. They would call us up, and we would send him up an airplane. And we dropped supplies for him also, but we did a lot of bringing supplies into him, into Sam Tong. And he just did the people got to love him up there,
mm-hmm.
and he just did an incredible job up there teaching them and teaching them how to grow. He was a farmer in Indiana, I think,
mm-hmm.
teaching them how to grow food. And he had a little medical clinic up there, and I think they were teaching nurses how to become nurses, and just totally humanitarian.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent, excellent man.
Do you know if he ever went to work for the CIA?
I would say no.
Okay.
I would say that he was always on the payroll of USAID.
Mm-hmm.
However, he used to interface with the CIA and get support from them all the time, but I don't think he was ever an agent, but you know, you just don't know.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I didn't see any requirement for him to work as a CIA case officer because he was getting paid from USAID and it was a legitimate job.
Yes, sir.
And but he may have been. I don't know.
Yeah. Now, did you bring your wife for this tour with Burdenson?
Oh, of course, yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
Where was she living?
Vientiane.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that you kind of got in country in a secretive fashion.
Wetback.
Yeah, wetback.
Yeah.
Well, once you were in country, did you not have to worry about getting caught without appropriate paperwork, whatever?
They got me the paperwork afterwards, you know. And, you know, it was
okay.
A kind of a funny thing, the way they did things. I don't even know why they wetbacked me in, because they could have just phoned me up, I think. It was kind of a funny drill. But they did it the way they did it, and then I gave my passport to Burdenson, and then maybe a week later I had everything I needed. It was funny the way they did it. But it was obviously a wetback.
Okay.
And it was obviously arranged by the CIA.
Mm-hmm. And what were the major differences between working with Burdenson versus your brief time with Air America in 62?
Oh, Air America was more of a military-style organization. And Burdenson was a construction company. And it was it wasn't as big, it was smaller, and everybody knew each other, and it was based strictly at Vientiane originally, and Udon, but everybody knew each other. Air America and its subsidiaries or other organizations were scattered all over Asia, you know, all over, like in Singapore and Tokyo and Taipei, Hong Kong, all over the place. So it was a small organization. It's kind of like the difference between working for a big airline or a small local airline like Northeast was out of Boston.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But the intelligence that you were getting over time while you were working for Burdenson was just as good as any intelligence you received while you served in Southeast Asia?
Oh, sure, but we used to go to the Flight Information Center and get it. And,
yeah.
you know, and we'd swap stories. We all drank coffee and had breakfast and drank our Heinekens at the end of the day in the coffee shop there at Vientiane.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we'd all swap war stories and we'd all tell each other where that they've been shot at and all that kind of thing. It just generally passing information between each other.
Mm-hmm.
It was all in the Flight Information Center anyhow, though.
Right. Okay.
So the intelligence was equal.
Mm-hmm.
Between the two companies.
Okay.
But it was actually supplied by Air America.
Mm-hmm.
But we had total access to it.
Okay. Now, when you were flying for Burdenson, did you ever engage in what they call in Air America special projects?
Special projects.
Yes, sir.
Well, I guess one special project would be the prisoner of war that I brought out.
Okay.
You know, at the Geneva Accords before they formed the Nuzis government at the Paris peace talks, the pro-Western side was always complaining about there were regular North Vietnamese, ARVN they used to call them, I think. North Vietnamese troops and layouts, and they always denied it. The communists will always deny it. So one day they caught one, and I just happened to be on the spot. And Tony Poe said, "Jim, you got to take this special prisoner of war down to Vientiane for us." And I said, "Okay." So they put the prisoner of war. They tied his hands behind his back with rope, and they put him in the back of the Dornier with a little Lao soldier guard, a young kid with a gun on his hip. And then they expected me to get in the front seat of that Dornier and fly this turkey down to Vientiane. And I says, "Oh, wait a minute, I don't like this situation at all." And I says, "First of all, I want this guy strapped to these two buckles on the floor." And I says, "So that he can't get away." And I says, "And I want the gun in my pocket. I ain't leaving that gun in the back."
Mm-hmm.
And so I did that as a security precaution because I knew this guy was scared to death. And we flew him down to Vientiane without incident. And it was the first North Vietnamese regular that they ever caught up there that I know of.
So
that was a kind of a special op.
Yeah.
As far as going off on any kind of a spooky thing, no. Everything was pretty much. Routine to us daily. We go off and make these drops around the country.
To include your operations into China.
Yeah, well, that was a special op, yeah. It was considered as a special op, you know.
Yes, sir. Now, when was this this POW captured? Do you recall?
You know, it was probably, it had to be 63 or 64,
mm-hmm.
somewhere in there.
Okay. And to your understanding, what happened to him? What was he used for? Was it just as proof that, yeah, they're there?
Well, they probably took him to Switzerland and put him in a fancy hotel somewhere and then interrogated him. He ate steak every night. I don't know what happened to him. I often wondered that myself. Maybe he testified at the Geneva Accords.
Well,
I'm sure they didn't kill him because he was too valuable, you know?
Yes, sir. Were there many other people captured that you're aware of?
I'm sure there were, but I don't remember seeing a lot of prison camps around, you know, for the enemy, mm-hmm. the communists.
Did you ever carry any Pathet Lao prisoners?
No.
Okay.
No. Not that I can remember, no. I used to carry a lot of pro-Western Laotian troops,
mm-hmm.
but I never carry any Pathet Lao prisoners, no.
Okay. Let's see. As far as the pro-Western troops, did you ever carry other country forces into Laos? In particular, of course, Thai forces.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Not many, though. Not many. There was not a big troop group of Thai soldiers up there. There were some that were working with the CIA
mm-hmm.
on special projects.
Mm-hmm. Now, were these the Thai paramilitary forces, the Peru? You know?
I think so. There was a guy by the name of McCorn at
mm-hmm.
Long Chen,
mm-hmm.
and he worked for Tony and Vinny, and his job was to go around every night, all of the villages, to the village chiefs and smoke the pipe with them, you know, with heroin or poppy. And the story is that, you know, I used to see him, and he was a tremendous guy. He spoke fluent English, I used to see him, and his eyes were bulging red, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me that he died. That he died later on from going around smoking the pipe with all of the village chiefs.
Goodness.
And he was kind of like making peace with them, you know, for the West,
mm-hmm.
to keep them friendly to us.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
But I think he was Peru.
Okay.
Paru.
Uh-huh. P A R U.
Yeah, it was the special forces of Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
They were trained over at Phitsanulok.
I'm sorry, they were trained what?
At Phitsanulok, Thailand.
Okay.
By Jack Shirley,
mm-hmm.
who was another CIA case officer.
Did you know or ever get to meet Bill Lehr?
Oh, many times, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
What do you remember about working with him?
Well, I didn't work with him very much because he was kind of off there in his shack, you know,
mm-hmm.
doing his thing, running, I guess, his case officers.
Mm-hmm.
I think I flew him maybe a couple times,
mm-hmm.
But I was definitely not exposed to an awful lot,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I can't say too much about him, to be honest, except I knew he was there,
mm-hmm.
and that's about it.
Okay.
He probably used to socialize with the guys at the club in Udon,
mm-hmm.
But I wasn't, you know, I was in Vientiane most of the time.
Right. Now, why don't you go ahead and describe briefly the living conditions for you and your wife in Vientiane?
Oh, it was delightful. We had the old French colonial house.
Mm-hmm.
The rent was inexpensive. We had maid's quarters in the back.
Mm-hmm.
It was all fenced in, a banana tree in the yard. We had a Jeep. And we had it all furnished with the rattan furniture.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a Sony tape recorder, one of the large ones with the speakers that were in favor in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a refrigerator, and you name it. We had everything.
Mm-hmm.
Very comfortable.
Okay.
So delightful, airy house. And upstairs, I had my own office up there, and just a fun experience.
Mm-hmm.
We were very comfortable.
Okay. Did you have any other family there?
No.
Okay.
But we did go through four coup d'etats in Vientiane.
Okay. What were those like?
Well, one of them was only one affected my wife. I was away flying somewhere, and we had two German shepherds, and one of them got out of the yard and got run over by an army truck with all the activity,
mm-hmm.
and the coup d'etat was out around the airport. There was a lot of mortar fire, so she went down to another part of town, but she was okay. It was mm-hmm. a kind of a frightening experience for her,
mm-hmm.
but she just split out of there, and that was the end of that. And I think that the next day she was back, so we were back in the house.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, something else happened to our house. Something happened to our roof. Oh, yeah, I think our roof got shot up in the house, too, when she was gone.
Mm.
Yeah, the coup d'etat was very close to, out near the airport, and of course, we lived right next to the airport, so.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty exciting, and that was the one that was very exciting to us. The other ones, they were internal, and I just don't remember much about them, but I just remember that there were four coup d'etats over there.
Okay. How about other oddities of living in Vientiane, the capital? Like, for instance, I understand that there were, in Vientiane, there was a Pathet Lao headquarters.
Yeah, correct. When I used to go to work, there were Pathet Lao guards there, as I recall, when I first got there.
Mm-hmm.
Around one of the Pathet Lao buildings,
mm-hmm.
maybe their headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of an eerie feeling, because they all had Tommy guns.
Okay. Well, were you guys allowed to carry weapons, personal weapons?
At first, but then they took them away from us, yes.
When did they take them away, and why, do you know?
I think Geneva Accords.
Okay.
It was taken away in 62, I think, 63,
okay.
maybe.
Okay.
I just can't remember all the details on that.
Yeah, okay.
I just do remember that we weren't allowed to carry guns, except a little pistol in our survival kit.
Okay.
22, it's a small. But I never worried about that because I figured if I went down somewhere, you know, I'd be better off without a gun because
mm-hmm.
I'd be so overrun with people, you know, that you know, if I started shooting at them, that'd be the enemy.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your survival kits, did that include a blood chip?
Never opened one, thank God, so I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I just heard there was a pistol in there.
Okay. And what about, what would you carry with you as personal stuff in case you got shot down? Anything in particular? Gold bracelets, anything like that?
No. Okay. I never carried anything
okay.
For that. So some of the guys used to joke about it, I think, more than they actually did it.
Uh-huh. Now, as far as your missions and the operational aspects of your work, you mentioned in the letter that you sent to Tim Castle about the SAR operations and SAR missions, things like that, that of course a lot of the times you wouldn't receive a specific call, you would not be out on a specific call or mission for SAR, but instead you'd be out on a mission for something else, and of course the SAR call would come in.
Sure. They always call the airborne airplanes first to get them in as quickly as they could.
Right.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that typically that's what you do. You drop what you were doing and you go and
absolutely
and see if you couldn't help.
We would abort the mission and go to the SAR.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was there ever a time where you couldn't drop what you were doing?
No.
And you had to stay on mission.
No.
Okay. Do you recall any other specific missions or operations that stand out in your memory?
I remember flying from Udorn in the Beaver program down to Paxay,
mm-hmm.
and the case officer down there. I met him. I flew him down there, although I was supporting special forces. He hopped on my airplane. His name was Ed Hall, and he was the case officer, and I flew him down to Paxay for his initial assignment.
Mm-hmm.
He quit Northeast Airlines to go to work for the agency, and I used to see him in Paxay occasionally when I was down there, and then I went to work for Northeast Airlines in 67 when I returned to the States, and who do I bump into but Ed Hall. He had quit the CIA, and he'd gone back to work for Northeast Airlines. And I bumped into him in Winthrop, Massachusetts, near Logan Airport in the ground school there. So it was kind of an interesting reunion.
That's funny. Did you keep contact with many of the people that you met in Southeast Asia over the years?
Oh, absolutely. Air America gang, sure.
Yeah. Okay.
Email. We have a big email net
mm-hmm.
up.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay. Now, as far as the rest of your time, though, in Southeast Asia, you eventually left Laos.
Yes, I was transferred to Vietnam.
Okay. And was this still with Bird & Son?
Yes. No, Continental then, but it was, Bird was bought by Continental.
Okay.
And I gave you that. It was bought for $4 million.
Right. The Continental Air Services Incorporated.
Right.
I guess before we talk about that transition, what had you heard about Cassie before going to work for them?
There was Continental Airlines.
Uh-huh.
That was basically it, and they were buying Bird & Son.
That's all you'd heard. Okay.
Sure.
Do you know if they were trying to keep it secret or anything?
No. No, it made the press. You got the news release on it.
Right, and they even took out advertisements.
Sure.
Yeah.
Those C-130s, they advertise those.
Right.
Yeah, I could state this, that, it was supposed to be aviation activity over there was supposed to be clandestine.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much so, it was only clandestine to the American people. Peking and Moscow and Hanoi knew all about it.
Yes, sir. Well, while we're on the subject of other foreign nationals, did you ever bump into any of them? I mean, we talked about the Pathet Lao that were in Vientiane, but how about other enemy foreign nationals, Chinese, Soviets? You ever meet any or see any?
I met some French people there, and there were Chinese people working for Air America and Bird Continental, and also a lot of Filipinos.
Right, but those were Chinese nationalists, right? From Taiwan.
Correct. Yes, Formosa.
How about a PRC Chinese?
No.
So
no, they weren't there. I mean, I think they had an embassy there, but
mm-hmm.
we never interfaced with them at all.
Not intentionally, but maybe in a bar.
Maybe, I just don't know, but I never talked to them,
yeah.
And I never knew who they were.
Do you know if there were any Soviets in Vientiane while you were there?
Yeah, there were Soviets there. I have to back off on that statement. They had the ICC was there,
mm-hmm.
and they had a white helicopter,
mm-hmm.
and it was the Poles were
mm-hmm.
were for the communist side. And the neutral. Let's see, who was neutral? I forget who represented the neutral faction, what country? But the Canadians represented the West in that commission,
mm-hmm.
and their job was to try to, keep peace. Mm-hmm. But it was a difficult job, and I got to be good friends with the Canadians.
Okay.
There were two Canadian officers, and my wife and I used to socialize with them a lot. I used to bring them over the house for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
Great, great guys. Can't remember their names, not too long ago.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, we get along great with Canadians anyhow.
Okay.
And never met any of the Polish ICC people, and I forget who the neutralist. I think India was the neutralist.
Okay.
Yeah, India.
Okay.
But I never met any of those people either. Russians were there probably in the embassy, but
mm-hmm.
I don't remember interfacing with them.
Okay. Now, in the ICC, you're talking about the International Control Commission?
Yes.
Okay. Huh. All right. Did you ever fly the Canadians or any of the ICC people?
No, they had their own helicopter.
Okay.
They had their own air support.
Okay. I don't know if maybe they chartered or contracted out any of their...
Well, they may have with Air America, and they may have with Bird or Continental. I just didn't know about it.
Okay.
But I don't ever remember hearing of them chartering anything, but I do know that they had the white helicopter. It was a Sikorsky H-34 with the black ICC on the side of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was supposed to identify them so that nobody would shoot at them, but it didn't do it didn't work a lot of the time. I used to get shot at all the time.
Okay. I guess they didn't have a flight information system like you guys did.
They used to go to the wrong places.
Yes, sir. Well, did that happen very often? Did Bird Air pilots ever make mistakes and fly into areas that they probably shouldn't have and get shot down?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It happened occasionally. I can tell you one great story.
Mm-hmm.
We had a very colorful guy over there by the name of Jim Four when I was with Bird and Son.
Mm-hmm.
And he was flying the P-2V, and he used to drop rice and supplies and whatnot. And he got a briefing. He was supposed to make a run up north of Ban Hui Sai and drop supplies.
Mm-hmm.
And the P-2V. And that was a two-man crew, as I recall. And he got information that there were 50 caliber machine guns up there. And he went over to Dutch, and he says, Dutch Bronkhorst was the chief pilot, flight manager, and he was the flight manager. Eric was the chief pilot. And he said, Dutch, I don't want to take this mission. They were doing the coffee shop where everywhere was around here. And he says, Dutch, I don't want to take this mission because they got this 50 caliber machine guns up there,
mm-hmm.
and I'm afraid I might get shot down. So Dutch, Jim was a big ego guy, you know. And so Dutch said to him, he says, Jim, he says, if you don't take that mission, I'm going to take it.
Mm-hmm.
So Jim Ford, you know, that was the boo's ego, you know. He said, okay, I'll take the mission. So he flew up there and got his ass shot down.
Oh, no.
It's a true story.
Was it by 50 cals?
Yeah, it was by the 50 calibers that he knew it was there. So I used to tell that story at when I was in the Army Reserve to mm-hmm. A bunch of helicopter pilots. I used to teach that as a... It's a safety item. You know, if the chief tells you to go up there, and you know there's guns up there, and if he says he wants to do the mission, then let him go.
Did they recover?
Everybody used to love that story. The safety brief. They're normally very, very boring sessions.
Mm-hmm. Did he get recovered?
Yeah, he got burned quite a bit. I think he broke his leg, but they pulled him out with a helicopter,
well,
as I recall. I know that he came
good.
Back, yeah.
Good.
Yeah, he was safe. Copilot was too.
Good. Okay.
But he said that he had to fight off a wild boar in the night that he was there in the jungle, but we don't know whether that was just baloney or what.
Interesting, a wild boar.
Yeah, yeah. That's the story he told, but Jim could tell some stories, I'll tell you.
Okay.
But he's a great guy. I used to fly with him as his co-pilot.
Mm-hmm.
Great pilot. He used to fly the Alaskan, the Dew Line in the C-46s.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible pilot.
How do you spell his last name?
F-O-R-E. He's in the... I think he's in the Air America log.
Okay.
He was out in Colorado somewhere.
Okay.
Somewhere out that way.
Okay. Any other memorable incidents where Bird and Son pilots were got into trouble?
Yeah, Dennis Fenno was up north of LP in that area that I was talking about, and he dropped down below the clouds in a Pioneer to drop stuff. He got all shot up, 4 or 5 rounds, I think, and he pulled out of there real quick-like.
Mm-hmm.
There was, that's pretty much it. There were a lot of other things, but I've forgotten a lot of them, and So I'll leave it at that.
Okay. What was the transition like from Burdenson to Cassock? Was there any change?
Yeah, there was definitely a change because there was a lot of new management that came in. They transferred me to Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and I wasn't too happy about that because I was so comfortable there living in Laos, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I only stayed in Vietnam a year. The flying was safer down there, believe it or not.
Safer in Vietnam?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were flying, we weren't dropping any supplies. We were carrying people around into the enclave. So it was quite safe. However, one day I was going north off the east coast, up south to Da Nang, and I was going northbound, and I was flying, and I was going over this, I think it was a destroyer escort,
mm-hmm.
and it was the U.S., and I wasn't concerned about it because I was coming from the south going up north,
mm-hmm.
and they opened fire on me. And, man, did I do a 90-degree turn and get the hell out of there.
Mm-hmm.
I was flying a Beechcraft Baron. I mean, the sky just was full of tracers.
Mm.
And I guess they were shooting anybody that flew over them. One of the interesting missions that I used to have down there, if this is the appropriate time to tell you about them.
Yes, sir, absolutely.
We did a lot of work for the Navy Bureau of Yards and Docks. And one mission that I used to do it was a weekly mission. I'd pick up this Navy captain. No, not a captain. He was the equivalent of an Army captain. Would he be a lieutenant, I think. And his job was to photograph all of the projects that were being built under contract to the Bureau of Yards and Docks, U.S. Navy. Airfields, hospitals, and all that, and I'd fly him for 12 hours all over. It was a long day, but it was a great day, and we would fly all over the enclaves, and he would take aerial photos of all of the, everything was being built, the airfields, to see what the progress was, and then we'd go back into Saigon at night, and the next morning, he was on a jet for Hawaii, where the photos were then sent on to Washington, D.C. for the Congress to look at.
Okay.
To see where the money was being spent.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think was a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see.
Well, when did you go to Vietnam?
66. January 66.
Okay. Now,
I left in, I think, October 66.
Okay. What, let's see. Well, while you were in Laos, what had you been hearing about, the major events that led to the U.S. military involvement in Vietnam, in particular the Gulf of Tonkin incident in 64, passage of the resolutions shortly thereafter, and the American military buildup. Had you been getting a lot of news and things like that in Laos?
Oh, sure. We used to listen to the VOA, and it was all covered in the Thai newspapers, and some of the guys used to get. We used to get the Wall Street Journal, but it used to come in like a week late by APO Air. And there was no shortage of information for us over there.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all.
Okay.
Well, everybody used to buy these Zenith transoceanic radios back in those days at the PX.
Mm-hmm.
And we could listen to the VOA and the BBC and Moscow and everybody with those down there. What a great radio.
Mm-hmm. Well, what when you left Laos...
Let me interrupt before I forget.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
The Stars and Stripes. We used to read the Stars and Stripes all the time.
You would get...
That was a pretty accurate newspaper.
Mm-hmm, okay.
Yep.
Now, okay. When you left Laos in 65, what was your opinion? What did you think about the U.S. activities there? How effective did you think U.S. Policies were in Laos?
I'll be very honest with you. I didn't really give it too much thought, to be honest with you.
Okay.
I figured that we were going to win, but we didn't.
Okay. What about in Vietnam? When you had started hearing about the U.S. buildup of military forces, obviously, when you compare what we did in Vietnam with what we were doing in Laos, where everything was covert and clandestine, in Laos, everything is overt and openly conventional military in Vietnam. What did you think about that? Did you give it any thought?
Oh, I believe it was incredible what they were doing.
Uh-huh.
But the loss of life there was devastating. And the way that they built airfields and the way they built hospitals and the way that they the way that the aviation assets did things. It was just incredible what our country could do there. However, looking back at it, it was all done wrong, and that's why we lost. And we could have won over there. There's absolutely no doubt about it. Mm-hmm. And I had lunch with General Westmoreland in Washington, D.C. in 1984, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And he personally told me that the major asset that he had as the commander of all those forces down there was the B-52. And not to knock the ground forces, because they were tremendous too. But he said that every time he was winning the war by bombing North Vietnam, then Washington, D.C. would take the B-52 away from him. Mm. He said that he had that war won so many times it wasn't even funny. But we all know that story, so I won't go into more of that.
Mm-hmm.
The military over there was had one hand tied behind his back.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we didn't win. But on the favorable side of that, we won the Saudi thing, mm-hmm. the Kuwait thing, Desert Storm, and the other one, and now the Afghanistan thing, because that we learned from our mistakes in Vietnam. And so that's why that we have become so damn effective.
Mm-hmm.
Then when they start those bombings, they don't stop.
Mm-hmm.
They just keep going.
Okay. Now, what in Vietnam, what kinds of missions were you typically flying? And what aircraft were you flying for CASIC?
I was flying mostly the Baron and the Dornier, and they were mostly support missions. They weren't dangerous at all.
When you say support, you mean for...
Carrying construction engineers...
Mm-hmm.
Mostly construction people for the RMK Brown Rutan Jones RMK BRJ combine.
Okay.
That was building all the airfields.
Okay.
It was mostly associated with the construction that was going on down there.
Okay.
It was an easy job.
Any military support?
Well, we used to get the guys. No, they had the military had their own support.
Mm-hmm.
We used to give guys hops, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If I was like at Camelot Bay and a guy wanted to go to Saigon, I'd say, yeah, get on, come on, hop on.
Mm-hmm.
We'd do that gladly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How about agency support?
I think Air America was doing most of that down there with their helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
But we basically speaking weren't that I know of or that I can recall of. It was mostly supporting the Bureau of Yards and Docks. And I think we did some work for USAID and information, USAID.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of thing.
Okay. And the other, you mentioned the one mission where you encountered basically a wall of tracers and banked out of there. Any other memorable operations while you were flying for CASI in Vietnam?
For Burdensun, yes.
For Burdensun?
Yes, one of the most frightening experiences was I was flying up north,
mm-hmm.
And I was checking out another pilot, and I was letting him fly. And I made a mistake in letting him fly.
Mm-hmm.
I ordered him not to go into a certain area, and the weather was bad
because
mm-hmm. it was outside the flight plan route. And he said, "No, it's shorter this way." And I let him do it. It was a mistake on my part. And we broke out over a mountaintop, and they opened up on us with a Schick burp gun. And I had bullets spraying all over the cockpit, and one of them hit me in the back. It didn't penetrate me, but because it was fairly well expended.
Mm-hmm.
But it burned me, and I thought I'd been hit hard, and I was going to feel it later on. But I just got a mark on there. If I was a military pilot, I'd have a purple heart from it.
Wow.
But it was a scary event. We had, I think we had hand grenades on it, or mortar shells that we were going to drop to friendlies. And anyhow, that was, I think the mountain was 8,000 feet high. And I called in for U.S. Air Force support. I don't know what happened to those guys, but I think they got what they had coming to them.
Okay.
And it was a very, very prominent location high on a mountain.
Yes, sir.
It was up north of the PDJ.
Okay. Were you ever wounded in any other mission?
No, that was the closest I got to getting wounded.
Okay. And you, you never lost an aircraft? While you're flying?
No.
Okay. Now, when you were in places like Lung Chin or other base areas in Laos, principally in Laos, did they ever come under significant attack, either artillery, mortar, rocket, anything like that?
Oh, yes. It was rare, but I was up the Plain du Jar one day,
mm-hmm.
And it was a funny situation because the neutralists, well, they were headed up by that General Kong Lee.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were there on the Plain du Jura on one side and the pro-Western on the other side. And then the communists with the, were at the far end behind Kong Lee and the neutralists.
Mm-hmm.
But they used to shift from day to day, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm up there one day in a Dawn Air, and I forget what the mission was, but I landed on the PDJ. And all of a sudden they started lobbing mortar rounds in at us. So I had to get in the trench. It was a bunker that they had built just for that. And I had to spend an hour in there. And then, fortunately, they didn't hit my airplane, so I got out and then flew out.
Mm-hmm.
But that was an exciting day.
Yes, sir.
Plain du Jura is one of the most beautiful spots in the world. And but the B-52s bombed the hell out of it.
Mm.
And they put it full of holes, big, you know, those big holes that the B-52 makes when they bomb.
Mm-hmm.
But the Laotians used their ingenuity and they made them into fish ponds now, so they got a lot of fish up there.
Wow.
that was an unusual article that the National Geographic Society wrote about several years ago.
Mm-hmm.
They normally don't get involved in the war stuff, but they did on this particular one.
Yeah.
It was an interesting article on Laos.
Well, while you were there, how frequently would the neutralists or the Western friendly forces, how frequently would they control a PDJ?
Most of the time, the western side of the, or the yes, western, I think the western side
mm-hmm.
of the PDJ was controlled by the pro-Western forces.
Mm-hmm.
However, they got overrun in the end.
Okay.
And the neutralists had maybe the middle part, but they would change from day to day. As a matter of fact, there was one Air America pilot that was going in there in a C-123. This was in 1962, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it was in 61 before I got there. I can't remember, but I know the story very well.
Mm-hmm.
He had a mission to go in with a plane load of supplies for the neutralists.
Mm-hmm.
And the neutralists shot him down in final approach and killed him.
Oh.
Yeah, it was a dirty deal.
And you mentioned Kong Lee. What about Veng Pao? Did you ever get to meet him?
Who?
Veng Pao.
Oh, many times, sure.
Okay.
I know him very well.
What do you remember most about working with him?
Oh, I enjoyed working with him. I used to fly him around, and he used to assign me missions sometimes
mm-hmm.
with Tony close by, you know, flying his people around, flying his intelligence people around. And if I stayed up there overnight, we'd socialize with him. And I liked him.
Mm-hmm.
He was a very tough guy, but he had a tough job,
mm-hmm.
and that's how he got to be a general, by being a tough guy.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd hate to be on the bad side of him in Laos, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally saw him, they had two prisoners. I think they were Pathet Lao prisoners, and they had them in a hole mm-hmm. there at Long Chen. And they grabbed the guards, the male guard's rifle, and they shot him, and they tried to get away, but
mm-hmm.
they got captured and shot by the Mayos,
mm-hmm.
Vang Pao's troops, and the bodies were laying on the ground, and I saw Vang Pao go with a hand. They were dead,
mm-hmm.
with a handcuffs, and he whipped them in the face with those handcuffs. Even though they were dead, he was so angry
mm-hmm.
that these guys had killed his people.
Mm-hmm.
So that was I saw the mean side of Vang Pao. That particular day.
Mm-hmm.
But no, he was very friendly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, when you were up country and working with people like Veng Pao or other Laotians, would you eat a lot of the food that they prepared, or did you guys carry your own?
Pretty much had our own, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But I didn't stay up there an awful lot then, but I think they were doing that after I left a lot because they built facilities that
okay.
were suitable. But we used to take our own stuff up there, you know, tuna fish and peanut butter and bread and stuff like
mm-hmm.
that.
Yeah. Did you eat much of the local cuisine?
No. I shouldn't say that. I used to like to go down to one of the Chinese noodle shops there in Vientiane
uh-huh.
and eat there. But most of the time we'd eat at home from the commissary.
Mm-hmm.
We had a commissary there. And we could get most everything except we couldn't get good fresh dairy products like milk.
Okay.
Because they didn't have any cows in Laos at that time. And when they're going on and out to Hong Kong, the first thing I want to do is get a glass of milk because they had a Danish cow dairy farm there in Hong Kong, so they had plenty of milk. But we used to get steaks from Australia, New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
We get butter from down there because it was a lot closer.
Yeah.
And easy to transport, a lot easier to transport there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in the commissary, and Air American, Bird, and Continental, we all had the APO privileges, and we had commissary and PX privileges.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever other privileges that the military could give to us.
Mm-hmm.
And, okay.
Well, while you were in Laos, was there much of a black market?
As I recall, there was a black market on airline tickets. So people used to swap the money around, and they could get airline tickets for 50% off.
Hmm, okay.
And I don't remember exactly how they used to work, but they used to play the kip against the dollar somehow, or the dollar against the kip.
Mm-hmm.
There was probably a black market there, but I didn't pay too much attention to it, or it wasn't of interest to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure there was goods coming across to Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
And but then in Vietnam, there was a big black market thing down there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you the story if you'd like to hear it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you know, the GIs in Vietnam, they couldn't have any dollars.
Mm-hmm.
They had what was called military scrip. So, but I used to be able to get dollars, being a civilian. So, I would go to the commissary. So, this is what all the guys were doing. We used to be able to take our dollars down to an Indian bookstore, and we would put the dollars in a book for this Indian, and what he would do is he would know where the book was, and then we would go to him and we'd say that we want another book, and then he would go to the book and get the dollars out, and then he would give us double the amount in script. It was all a coded operation, you know. And then we go down to the commissary, and we have $200 in script to spend at the commissary.
That's
black market, I guess, right?
Yes, sir, it is. Wow. Okay.
There was a lot of that went on, but there was an awful lot of black market stuff in the streets,
uh-huh.
Stuff that was smuggled in that we used to see. But one of the funniest stories over there was the McNamara hairspray situation where there were no wives there for the GIs, but... In the commissary, there was these huge displays of hairspray on the end of the grocery aisle.
Okay.
And that made Newsweek, because it was going to all their girlfriends, all the GI's girlfriends. Another funny story around there.
Okay. Any other black market or other bizarre activities involving American products in Vietnam?
No, I can't. You know, I can't put my finger on anything right now.
Okay.
USAID used to send a lot of stuff into Laos.
Uh-huh.
It was cases of canned goods and supplies and stuff, and it was all marked a present for the United States of America with a handshake on it. You know, an
mm-hmm.
American flag. And,
mm-hmm.
and we supplied a lot of that stuff in there.
Okay. Into Laos?
Yeah, it was in Vientiane in Laos. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think I used to see it in Vietnam too.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It was a USAID giveaway.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, this will end CD number one, the interview with Mr. James McFarland. This is CD number two, the interview with Mr. James McFarland. When you were near the end of your tour in Vietnam, which would have been... I think you said in October of 1966, is that correct?
Yeah, somewhere around there.
Well, what was the purpose for your leaving, what were your impressions upon leaving? How did you think things would turn out in Vietnam?
Well, I figured that we would win,
mm-hmm.
because we had such an incredible machine over there. But it didn't work that way, because the Washington just wasn't supporting it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt about that. Not like they did in the Desert Storm and in Afghanistan. You know, they just let the military run the operation, and the politicians kept the nose out of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we won in both of those campaigns. And a lot of those senior people in either one of those campaigns they were Vietnam majors, lieutenant colonels,
mm-hmm.
and they understand what happened over there. But I left because I had a good friend of mine who was on furlough. He was the assistant chief pilot for Air America. His name was George Posky. He was a World War II fighter ace.
Mm-hmm.
He shot down five Zeros. He was in Pappy Boynton's squadron. He flew Corsairs. And he was on furlough from Panagra Braniff and flying for Air America as the assistant chief pilot in Vientiane. And he kept telling me, he says, Jim, you know, this is only a temporary thing over here. And he says, once you make your money, get out of here and go to work for the airlines. So I figured it was time to do it. And also my mother was very ill with cancer back in here in Augusta, Maine. So I came back on a extended leave, and I got a job at the airline, so I never went back.
Okay.
That's basically it.
Okay. When you got back to the United States, what did you think about the tenor inside this country as far as supporting the war and how that evolved over time? Because when you came back in 66, most Americans were still pretty much supporting the war effort. The anti-war student movement was beginning to pick up, of course. But what did you think about all the events in the United States as they unfolded as the Vietnam War continued?
Well, it was certainly very, very interesting, I watched it like everybody else did in the newspapers, and I was still flying. I came back to the United States to go to the airlines, and I went to work for the airlines, and they turned around and sent me back to Vietnam. And I was flying the troops back and forth in a military craft airplane, Civilian Relief Air Force.
Oh.
Military contract.
Mm-hmm.
So I was still involved in the war. And I was based at Clark and flying into Vietnam, getting shot at again. I went away so I didn't get shot at anymore, right? I'm right back in there again.
Okay.
So, I really wasn't forming any opinions at that time about the war. I was in it, and I was going along with it and doing my thing and supporting it. But it's afterwards that I formed a lot of opinions, and I've already pretty much given those to you.
Mm-hmm.
I got heavily involved in the POW MIA thing in the 80s, and I even lived in Thailand for a year.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to develop intelligence on POW MIA.
Mm-hmm.
Was that right after I retired?
Okay.
And so my opinions about the war were all formed after the war was over.
Okay. Now, you said that part of your employment after you left CASI involved, flying American troops back to Vietnam,
correct,
and forth from Vietnam. How did you feel about that?
Well, I'll give you my experiences.
Mm-hmm.
One night we were at Da Nang, mm-hmm, in a DC-8. We had 250 troops on board, mm-hmm, getting ready to take all these guys out. And all of a sudden, the tower told us to pull off to the side, and they wouldn't let us go because there was a big firefight out the end of the runway. And we sat there for 40 minutes watching the flares and the mortars get thrown around.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally they said, okay, the brush fire is over, you guys can take off. And, it was a pretty tense situation.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys on the ground, these guys in the back of the airplane, they put their ear in and they're saying, holy Christ, I ain't going to make it out of here,
Yeah.
And I didn't talk to anybody, I know that's what they're thinking,
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking the same thing myself. But anyway, we got the green light to go and we took off. And right after we rotated, probably we were a couple hundred feet in the air and we were pulling up the gear. Right after the gear came up, 250 guys in the back started clapping. They were so happy to get out of Vietnam safely. And we took them to, the Philippines. And then somebody else took the airplane, they took them on to Travis. So that was one experience. The other experience that I noticed is that when Tricky Dickey said, well, he was trying to wind down the war, he says, we're going to pull out, I think it was 40,000 troops out of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And I was flying that run, with the troops.
Mm-hmm.
And he maybe pulled 40,000 troops out, but he put 40,000 troops back in.
Because mm-hmm,
I never ferried any airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
They were always full of troops both ways.
Mm-hmm.
So that was another experience that I noted on the thing. But one of the things that I didn't like was sometimes I had to bring back the dead bodies and the caskets.
Yes, sir.
And that was a gruesome, thought. That all these poor guys had lost their lives over there.
Yes, sir.
And that was the downside of the job.
Mm-hmm.
And I always felt very badly about that. I've never forgotten that. And
was that was,
The Mac airless thing was just absolutely incredible. What it could move, the civilian part of it only.
Mm-hmm.
What did it could move back and forth to Vietnam from the United States? It was unbelievable. Most airlines were involved in a Pan Am and Airlift and Universal and Trans-Caribbean Airways and World and Eastern was involved in, I believe, and some others.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just unbelievable what this country can do with the airlift.
Yes, the carrying of caskets and dead soldiers and Marines and airmen and sailors back, you did that from Vietnam to Clark. You never carried them all the way back to the U.S.?
Oh, you know, I forget which leg it was on because sometimes I was based at Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I was based at Guam.
Mm-hmm.
But I can remember, yeah, it was from Vietnam to the United States.
Was this every flight? Did you bring back remains?
No. Sometimes we'd come back empty. Sometimes we'd have broken airplanes in there.
Interesting. Okay.
Freighters. You know, we if it was passenger, we always brought passengers back.
Right.
But a lot of times we hauled freight out there.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, I remember the Tet Offensive,
mm-hmm.
That they almost ran out of bombs and ammunition out there.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a couple airplanes on that. I was with Trans-Caribbean Airways there, a DC-8, so we had a couple airplanes on there.
Mm-hmm.
But we had to throw three more airplanes. And we only had like 9 airplanes, so they took most of our fleet. Because if you were in the craft program, you had to, you had to give part of your fleet to it.
Mm-hmm.
And this was an emergency thing, so we were shipped down to Dover, and we were flying flights out of Dover with bombs and ammunition into Vietnam steadily until we could build up the reserves over there, because they were just about out of ammunition over there.
Wow.
But it wasn't only us; it was Pan Am and. We just see all the outfits down there hauling bombs and stuff back to Vietnam.
You remember what time period? This was Tet 68?
Yeah.
Tet 68, they almost ran out.
That's right. My brother was a Marine fighting door-to-door in Wei. And I'm in his house right now.
Uh-huh.
And he recalls that vividly.
That they almost ran out of ammunition.
Oh, yeah. Everybody knows that they almost ran out of ammunition. They're getting very low, yeah. That was a big offensive.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There was a lot of rounds fired. Mm-hmm. A lot of bombs dropped.
Yes, sir. Now, not to harp on the subject, but I did have one more question about you having to ferry back casualties.
Yeah. No, I don't mind.
Did you have occasion where you were bringing back both soldiers, returning soldiers, and casualties at the same time? Or did you only carry casualties and caskets and freight, aircraft?
Yeah, strictly cargo planes, yeah.
Strictly cargo?
Yeah, never with... never with passengers on board, no.
Okay.
However, there may have been some in the belly that I didn't know about, but I don't think so.
Okay.
Because usually we'd see the stuff on the ramp, you know, before they loaded it.
Right. Good enough. Well, did you notice during the Tet period, was there any kind of change in your approaches? You know, how would you guys get intelligence about how to come into Saigon or Tonsonet? Or whatever.
Well, Saigon was already programmed for that.
Uh-huh.
Because the ILS was tilted up like 3 degrees to 9 degrees or something.
Mm-hmm.
I forget the exact amount, but we always did a steep approach into Saigon, so you couldn't make it any more steep than that. And mm-hmm. if you're going into Cameron Bay, then that was safe over there anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
And Da Nang, yeah, most of the approach is over the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, I don't remember any change... as a result of Tet 68 for the airliners coming in there.
Okay.
No, and I didn't hear of any either.
Okay.
You know, it's pretty hard to make any drastic changes in what was already there for safety purposes, because those airplanes are all heavy, you know,
mm-hmm.
and they just don't maneuver very well.
Yes, sir. Okay. And did you, when you were doing this commercial flight, did you get hit coming in?
No, did not.
Wow.
No, but I know of the planes that did, yeah.
Okay.
Commercial.
Mm-hmm.
But I was lucky. I never did, no.
Okay. So how frequently, you said you're flying out of both Clark and Guam, but you were also at times flying out of the United States, out of the continental United States.
Yeah, well, we did it in different ways, because mm-hmm. we did it for 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I get 2 weeks in Hawaii and then fly a trip to Manila, or the Clark, then another crew would fly it into Vietnam and come back, and we'd have 12 hours rest, and we'd fly it back to Hawaii.
Okay.
And we were there, and then another crew would take it back to the States. And we were there for 2 weeks, and then they'd send us home, because we're out of time. Mm-hmm. And we'd have 2 weeks back in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd put another crew at Hawaii. Other times, what we call leapfrog.
Mm-hmm.
We'd fly from Dover to, I think, the bombing, when we replaced all the bombs and ammunition, that was a leapfrog operation out of Dover.
Mm-hmm.
We'd start at Dover and fly to Hawaii. Another crew would be in position. We'd get rest there. And see, there were a lot of flights there, so this is how the leapfrog would work. And then another crew would take that airplane away, and then there would be another airplane coming in after we got our rest. And then we would fly it to Guam, and then and we would get off from Guam and get our crew rest, and another airplane would be coming. And then we would fly it on into Vietnam, and then bring it back to Guam, and then get a night's rest, and then the other plane coming out of Vietnam. So it was a leapfrog operation.
Yes, sir.
We wouldn't stay in one place more than a day or two.
Mm-hmm.
However, January of 1970, I spent the entire month in the Philippines.
Mm.
And the crews that were there, I think we had three or four crews there, and it was strictly our job to fly the airplane in and out of Vietnam for a whole month.
Mm-hmm.
And the other crews would feed it to us from Guam or Wake or where it was, Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
And they would rest it at the hotel there outside the gate there at Clark Air Force Base. And they would rest while we took the airplane into Vietnam. We'd bring it back 12 hours later,
mm-hmm.
and then they'd fly it back to Hawaii. And there was a crew. Then there'd be a crew based in Hawaii that would take it on to Travis or something.
Mm-hmm.
So we either were in position for a month, or we did a leapfrog operation.
Okay.
The leapfrog operation, as I recall, was for the Tet offensive,
because
we didn't have time to get guys in a position on the crews out there, you know, to base them and get hotels and all that.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you got to move right now, guys.
Okay.
That's how desperate they were for ammunition out there.
My goodness. Okay. Now, did you have occasion, as you were ferrying soldiers, especially back from Vietnam, did you ever have occasion to talk to many of them?
No, not really.
Okay.
No, we're just too busy with our duties, you know?
Yeah.
No.
Absolutely. Okay.
Oh, an hour before the flight, preparation,
mm-hmm.
flight plans, weather, all that.
Right.
Then we get in the cockpit and go.
Yes, sir. Okay. And what did you think about Nixon's plan to withdraw the U.S., that is, the Vietnamization program? Did you hear much about it? Were you able to form an opinion about it?
No, only what I told you.
Yeah.
About the 40,000 out and 40,000 in.
Right.
That's about it, yeah.
Okay. What did you think about the Paris Peace Accords of 1973?
I guess they were favorable, right?
Well, we got our prisoners back.
Yeah, some of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it ended the war.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the accords you're talking about. There were several Paris Peace Talks.
Right.
Yeah, those are the ones that ended the war. But
right.
But the war in Laos continued on.
Well, what do you remember in terms of where you were, what you were doing in 1975 when Saigon fell and it was official? Vietnam was reunited under communism.
I was with, I was flying for American Airlines then.
Okay.
And I was glad the war was over because I knew that our guys were getting killed over there.
Yeah.
And, I was flying domestically, so I wasn't involved in the war anymore.
Yeah.
And like I said, I was glad it was all over.
Yeah.
And so were a lot of other people.
Yes, sir. Well, you said that after you retired, you went back. When did you retire?
I retired in the first of 80, the late 86.
And
I retired 10 years early.
Okay. And you said you went back into Southeast Asia.
Yeah, I spent a year there tracking POWs.
What did you learn?
I didn't come up with any positive information, intelligence. There was definitely anybody there
mm-hmm.
who didn't want to be there. But however, that doesn't mean that they didn't hold a lot of our guys back. There's just so many stories about them being held back from various people.
Mm-hmm.
But I can never, you know, lock in any firm intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
However, there are some people that said, oh, that want to stay there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty sure that the story that I heard, because of the source, that it was true,
mm-hmm.
that they were there.
Mm-hmm.
And I reported whatever I had to Attorney Mark Waple down in Fayetteville.
Mm-hmm.
He's the man who sued the President of the United States. And I worked for Project Freedom on it, and General Westmore was our national honorary chairman.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I was able to communicate with him. And he made a speech for me down at Washington, D.C., at the National ROA, Reserve Officers Association,
mm-hmm.
meeting,
mm-hmm.
the year 1984.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a year to get him there, because he's in such demand, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he usually gets, back in those days, he would usually get $5,000 for a speech. But he spoke there for free.
Wow.
And I offered to buy him his airline tickets, and he bought his own airline ticket from South Carolina. He lives in Charleston.
Mm-hmm.
And he made a speech there on a variety of topics, and he hit the POW thing. And he said that they're being held over there. And he got like 17 standing ovations in, I don't know, half an hour or something like that.
Goodness.
And that was quite a day for me to be able to put that together.
Mm-hmm.
It was in front of 300 ROA officers. In the same hotel where Ronald Reagan got shot.
Okay.
On the outside.
Mm-hmm. Well, what drove you to go back and try to track POWs? Did you personally believe that before you went that they were still U.S. POWs being held against their will in Southeast Asia?
Oh, yeah, I believe that, yeah. Yeah. I still do.
Okay.
But, you know, it's impossible to access them, you know.
Mm-hmm. What led you to conclude this?
Because of all the intelligence that I have, one of the main things that came up was the DIA in Washington D.C. is responsible for all that.
Mm-hmm.
In the end,
mm-hmm.
And I knew a lawyer from Florida who was in the reserves and got assigned up there for a couple of weeks, I think, in the summer, and he came out of there. And he's saying that they're holding up POWs over there.
Mm-hmm.
And also, there's another guy who was the congressman from North Carolina, and I can't remember his name right now, but he worked in there. He lost his bid for election in North Carolina, and he worked in the DIA section there on the POW thing. And he came out of there, and he says his POWs in there.
Mm-hmm.
And after he did that, he ran for election again, but he had they put a nuclear dump waste in his district in North Carolina, so he lost.
Mm-hmm.
They did it to him on purpose. And then there was a full colonel who ran the DIA, and he was newly assigned to it.
Mm-hmm.
And he was only there like 2 months, and he was taking a look at the stuff there, and he came to the conclusion that they were holding POWs over there. Now, this is the Defense Intelligence Agency in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
They're not in the Pentagon. I think they have a separate building.
Mm-hmm.
But you know the DIA.
Mm-hmm.
And he got so angry about the whole thing that he resigned in protest.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I have his letter somewhere. I should have sent it to you.
Mm-hmm.
It was a 10-page letter, a 5-page letter, something like that, very lengthy.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Okay, guys, to the Department of the Army, I'm retiring because if I don't retire, what I have to say in this letter, then I know where I'd end up, and it would be like Kodiak, Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be the end of my career, so I'm going to leave. I'm retiring now anyhow, and I'm leaving this message." And he says, this agency is nothing but a debunk organization, and it is designed to discredit all of the reports that come in on POWs and MIAs. And he says, "I think that there's still POWs and MIAs being held over there." And so what he did with this letter of resignation, he pinned it to his door, and he walked out.
Oh, my goodness.
I forget his name now, but now, I got the document. I got the document within a week of it was his resignation.
Mm-hmm.
Because somebody in there sent it out to somebody in our group, and they sent it to me right away.
Mm-hmm.
And so I made the document public.
Mm-hmm.
It was classified.
Mm-hmm.
It was classified like in 10 days after the Army realized what was going on.
That's for crying out loud.
But I got it before it was classified, so I could do whatever I wanted with it. So those are the reasons, plus working over there, yeah. And developing the intelligence that I did.
Yeah.
You know, when the smoke was fire. And one of the problems I had on the border is there's all these con artists over there that would muddy up the waters, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And... But I still feel that they held a bunch of our men. Probably 300-400.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, where did you go when you went back in 86?
Well, I spent the time between Bangkok and mostly Nakhon Phnom.
Mm-hmm.
I spent a lot of time in Nakhon Phnom because mm-hmm. it was a fairly decent hotel there. And down in Mukdahan part of the time. And sometime over with Tony in Udon. Because they had a good hotel over there, and I wanted to go see Tony and swap stories with him. Because
mm-hmm.
he was still living there, and he's living in San Francisco now,
mm-hmm.
as you can tell from the directory.
Yes, sir.
And that's pretty... Well, I did spend a little time in Udon.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I think it was mostly transit to getting up to Mukdahan, because that was the easiest way to get to Mukdahan.
Okay.
I used to fly up on Thai Airways, but I rented a truck and drove up there with a pickup truck one time. And I rode the train once, and that was never again.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long, long trip. And that's about it.
Okay. Well, when you were visiting with Tony Poe, what was his opinion of this, whether or not there were POWs left? Did he have one? Or do you remember?
He would question everything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He would never say that there was nobody up there, but he would question everything, you know,
mm-hmm.
as to the validity of the information I had.
Okay.
Yeah.
And were you ever able to develop sources in Vietnam concerning the POWs?
No, it's too far away from there.
Okay. So where do you think they were kept? They were held.
Oh, I have a map somewhere as to where they were. There were some up in up around Dien Bien Phu,
mm-hmm.
and there were other camps in central Laos. But it's been too long now.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
For me, and they were in remote places and not in big cities. So I can't, you know, like if it was in Savannah Khet, I would say Savannah Khet. But it was always out in the jungle, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't really specify that without finding my map.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I don't even know what it is because, you know, I just moved and I'm all packed up now.
Oh, yes, sir. Okay. What did you do after you returned from Southeast Asia? In 87?
Yeah, I was over there in part of 87 also.
Mm-hmm.
Not much. I just stayed in retirement. I traveled and I started traveling to Costa Rica and Ecuador.
Mm-hmm.
Because Thailand was too far away from me, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, in some of the materials that you sent us, there's a reference to the movie Air America.
Yes.
And in particular, it's a response from Leon Lechaume, former president of the Air America Association.
Oh, yeah, Leon, yeah.
And it's a response to a letter that you must have sent to him and the association concerning the movie. I was wondering what your thoughts were on that movie, and in particular, the obvious... allegations that Air America pilots and other civilian pilots were flying drugs and engaged in nefarious activities in Southeast Asia.
Oh, yes, I can tell you a lot about that.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Thailand when, I can't remember his name now, but maybe it's there in the letter, the director of that filmmaker, Carol Ko.
Mm-hmm.
They're on the big board, I think.
Mm-hmm.
They're in one of the stock exchanges.
Mm-hmm.
From Hollywood, he came out there and he heard that I was in town from somebody, and he sent somebody over to see me, some British guy that was in the film industry or something, and he contacted me, and he said that he wanted to know that if I would go up to Udon with the producer that's going to make the movie Air America, and show him around. I said sure, I'd be glad to, and so they bought me a ticket, which wasn't not much, $40 to get up there, and. So, first of all, I tried to get Tony to let us into the Air America facility, you know, because he lived there. I figured he had the connections, and he couldn't get the connections to let us into the Air America compound because, you know, it's Thai Air Force now. And got a hold of George Getsky, who's used to run Just Mag down in Bangkok back in 1970. He's still there. He's almost 70 now. He's still jumping with the Peru over there from the twin pack Sikorsky helicopters, and he got me permission to go in there with the producer of Air America, And he had his young French wife with him, and we all flew up there. And George came along, too. George Getsky, Colonel, retired U.S. Army. Really great guy. He was in one of the movies that they did on some of that stuff over there. I can't remember the name of it now, but he did a real short part in it. And we all went up to Udorn to see the facility, and they let us in there. But I was given the transcripts of the movie, and it was filthy loaded with drug stuff, and I wasn't very happy about that at all. And so, but I did my thing with them up there, and I showed them all around, and it was really interesting. I took all kinds of pictures, which I think the Air America Association has, and of the hangars, how they were all run down and whatnot, and you know, with the pool and the old, and where the school was and the old office buildings and all. It was fun to show them all that, and where Bird and Son, their hangar used to be. It was a great day for me. It really was. It was 20 years after I'd been there. And George enjoyed it, too. And I complained to the producer. I said, you know, this is not true, what you're writing in here. You know, this is disastrous to us because, you know, it's bad for our reputations when we go try to get jobs and that sort of thing because, you know, what you're writing is not true. So that had an impact upon him, but the Air America Association dumped on him and threatened with lawsuits and everything. So he cut it. He cut 90% of that drug stuff out of there.
Mm-hmm.
But he had to see it, leave some of it in there, because that's Hollywood, you know?
Yes, sir.
So Fred Walker was also asked to... I wouldn't help him anymore. So Fred Walker was asked to be an advisor in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
He was up in Freiburg, and he was given a ticket by this guy, and he went out to Hollywood, and he met this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he too, wouldn't work with this guy because of all the drug stuff and the transcripts.
Mm-hmm.
So the combination of he and I and the Air America Association, we got most of it out of there, but there was still a little bit left in there. But my answer to the drug thing is it's a bunch of bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
It's communist propaganda. I never saw any signs of anything like that going on in the 5 years that I was over there.
Mm-hmm.
But I do remember when I was in Vietnam, I used to fly to an island called Con Son.
Mm-hmm.
And Con Son hit the headlines because the political prisoners from the South Vietnam regime were supposedly on the island of Con Son, and they were in this jail down there, and they were living off their own urine. And I, on one of my flights down there, I walked down to the jail, and it was empty. And I said, this is all communist propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the drug thing is.
Mm-hmm.
On Air America, it's all communist propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
That's how they turn the people against their own government.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that in the Frank Church, Senator Frank Church hearings,
mm-hmm.
in the Senate in 1976, that entire thing was investigated, and the Senate committee ruled there's no evidence of any such thing going on. It's just not factual.
Mm-hmm.
So that runs the value pretty good.
Okay. Well,
I have to fight that off all the time with people, you know.
Really?
You know, I get needle on it all the time, and I have to, you know, mm-hmm. let right into them, you know,
mm-hmm.
and let them know my stand on it.
In terms of when you're talking about your flying experience with other pilots and stuff?
Well, anytime anybody knows that I'm with Air America, and uh-huh. sometimes, not anytime, but once in a while it comes up, you know.
Yeah. Is that misconception based on the movie?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I think it's from communist propaganda.
Right.
That's where I think it came from.
No, I'm sorry. When you meet someone today, and if they start ribbing you about, well, oh, you guys were flying drugs in Laos or whatever, is that misconception that person today in the United States that they have, do you think that is based on the movie?
No.
No?
No.
Because I would imagine that that's a more likely avenue of information for
people.
Well,
it could be part of it, but
yeah.
There was the reputation that we're slammed with by the... By the comments.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And don't tell me where it came from, because you never know.
Yeah.
That's the way propaganda flows, you know, disinformation.
Right. Okay. Well, let's see. Have you seen some of the other documentaries that involve Air America? Flying Men, The Flying Machines?
I've seen some of those, yeah.
What do you think of those, how they were done?
Let me see.
Do you recall what they covered and...
Yeah, they were all okay.
Okay.
There's different versions of them.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that they're all okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
I would say that they were quite accurate, unlike the movie, you know.
Yes, sir.
Unlike the Air America movie.
Right.
Done by Carol Cole.
Mm-hmm. What do you think we should take away from our experiences in Southeast Asia, the United States?
Well, I think we've taken it already. We've learned the mistakes of how not to win a war.
Mm-hmm.
That's for sure.
Okay.
We've also learned maybe that there's certain places in the world that we should keep our nose out of.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know where that war would have gone. Whether the communists and the Chinese would have pushed south through Thailand down to Singapore,
mm-hmm.
or not,
mm-hmm.
we'll never know. But that was supposedly the theory in those days,
mm-hmm.
and that's why that John F. Kennedy put the original battalion of helicopter-borne Marines in 1962 into Thailand because of that threat.
Mm-hmm.
And so history history as is it is, and we'll just never know the answer to that. But we learn a lot from that, an awful lot from that.
Okay. Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to discuss today?
No. Let me take a look at my notes here. I didn't make many notes here because I knew you had a lot of questions.
Mm-hmm.
I still can't remember the name of that captain, the captain for Air America based in Taipei, but I'll find it out for you.
Okay.
No, I guess that's about all.
Okay. Well, let me put an official ending to this. Thank you very much. This will end the interview with Mr. James McFarland.